Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So Jake, Blood and Guts, a lot of buildup, in a way a year in the making, headlined AEW Dynamite tonight, lots of blood, some guts shown in a figurative sense, nobody was disemboweled, which is good. Your thoughts overall, what's your evaluation of the payoff to the Pinnacle versus Inner Circle in the return of essentially War Games? Jake, I can't hear you. Oh, see if we can bring Jake back in here. You can hear me now. Hello, Jake. Jake left again. Keep trying here. Stand by, everybody.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Stand by again, everybody.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So tonight, AEW, after about a year of buildup, after the original Blood and Guts concept match had to be canceled or was canceled due to the pandemic, the Inner Circle and the Pinnacle battled in the main event of a memorable episode of AEW Dynamite that felt like a big deal. And in the main event, Sammy Guevara yelled, "We surrender," when MJF was threatening to throw Chris Jericho off the roof of the double cage. It was a bloody match. MJF, Dax, and Cash especially bloodied in this one. Lots of weapons, including Jericho's baseball bat, chairs, a fork, the metal part of a turnbuckle, not the pad, the actual metal part. And it was a traditional War Games match with the usual battle back and forth with different wrestlers the Pinnacle having the advantage every other time, and then the babyfaces returning and evening the odds as the match progressed. Jake, what did you think?
Am I back? Jeez.
Yes, you are.
Wow, that was a weird experience.
It'll all be edited out, so we don't have to talk about it. we're good. So, Jake, what did you think of the payoff to what was apparently back in the 70s? This was called Blood and Guts. But anyway, that's another topic. What do you think of the payoff to the Blood and Guts concept, AEW style, tonight?
I actually enjoyed the match. I thought, for the most part, it was good. The commercial breaks really cut into the flow of things. And so in the future, I might hold this one off for pay-per-view. But in terms of the structure, you know, getting setting up the advantage for the Pinnacle team, setting up meaningful entries for each of the competitors, delivering on the stipulation. I mean, there was enough blood in this match for a Tarantino film. It was all over the place. You know, I thought for the most part they delivered. Now, some of the unprotected chair shots and other things I could have lived without, but I think they set out to deliver what they promised for this match, and for the most part they did a good job.
Yeah, unprotected chair shots. I'm not excited at all to see those brought back. I don't care what the excuse is. The violence level delivered as promised. I do want to get to an issue I had with the match, which was the finish. I don't like the idea of a double cage. They're locked in. They fight till a surrender. And so we can do a spot on a roof. We're going to destroy the concept that they're trapped and have a couple wrestlers escape and go fight on the roof. I thought that it took away from the sense of it being a five-on-five epic battle. I know Ross tried to cover for it by saying the other eight wrestlers are just lying on their backs for an extended period of time because of fatigue. I mean, good. I'm glad he said that, but this is five-on-five, and to just have it come down to one-on-one on a roof I didn't like. And then you had the contrivance of MJF threatening to throw Jericho off the roof and Santana Ortiz begging him not to and Sammy Guevara yelling, "We surrender." You could call it a clever finish because nobody really had to give up when they were in a position of vulnerability. But, I mean, I think you watch War Games / Blood and Guts to see somebody give up, not somebody throw in a white towel. And that's essentially what happened here. And then you have MJF throw Jericho off the roof, which is a very heelish move to do. You know, they surrender to avoid that happening, and MJF does it anyway. But I'd rather have a wrestling move or hold or weapon and a match than yet another super-duper fake-looking crash pad landing that everybody sees through. As the announcers play dumb and gasp and act like that didn't look like it was a totally prepared crash landing onto a pad. I thought it was an eye-rolling finish in an eye-rolling stunt to end things. I don't think anybody's buying it. And I didn't sense – I mean, I could love to hear from somebody who was in the building tonight – but I didn't sense the crowd loved the finish or acted like that was a particularly satisfying finish. So I have my critique of the final few minutes of the match, Jake. What do you have to say to that?
No, I think it's a fair critique. If they're going to do the crash pad finish, wouldn't you have the team that's losing surrender after they see that level of violence? Like, my critique was more along the lines of, if you're going to have him shove him off the cage anyway. I mean, he doesn't really get any heel bonus points for doing it after the bell. It would have made for a more satisfying conclusion to have it be a shocking moment that forces the other team to concede, because now he's basically knocked out of the match. But I guess the psychology of it, you know, they kind of covered for the cage escape by saying that it was, you know, Tully Blanchard had basically stolen the key from Bryce Remsburg, I believe was the order of events, but you didn't really see it full screen. It was kind of something that was happening picture in picture, and so
pretty vital part of the match to not have full screen.
Yeah, and then in the previous commercial break, you had them, you know, unscrewing turnbuckle pads and uncovering the floorboards of the ring and stuff like that. And so there were some key action points in the match that was basically, you know, covered by ads. And so that's where I think in the future, you know, you got to show these things in their entirety in some way, shape, or form. But I think the criticisms of the finish are valid, and I'm sure there are others who felt the same way. But I applaud at least the effort of the competitors in the ring, because I think they really did go out there and set to keep their promises of their promos from recent weeks.
Yeah, no, I agree that, you know, the wrestlers did their part and the commercial breaks were a necessary evil. And, you know, we're critical of how all they do is grab a headlock during commercial breaks and nothing really happens, so why do split screen anyway? But to have real pivotal moments in the match happen, I didn't like. I think that MJF shoving Jericho off the roof after the surrender makes a lot of sense. I like that, actually. I think that MJF didn't do it to win. He did it after he already won. I think there's a whole heaping additional heel heat that comes with that. Everything goes. Anything goes. There are no rules in the match. But when you win, then you add that, you shove them off the top. To me, that's heel heat. If he does it in the course of the match, there's no heel heat. Everybody's hitting each other with weapons. You know, if it's legal to fight outside the ring, which is, you know, dumb. I still just don't. The Tully cover story does nothing for me. Now, in a meta sense, everybody knows AEW decided to have two wrestlers leave the cage, and they devised a contrived way to sort of explain why it happened. But I think you ruin the idea of a cage being 5-on-5. No one can get in, no one can get out. When you put a roof on the cage, there's a reason for that. It's not to do a stunt off the top. It's to keep people from leaving or entering. And now you've said, oh, but we don't really have good security for the key. So I don't like that either. I thought it was overbooked. And like I said, I just think, I mean, Jake, isn't the crash pad overdone? It's like I groaned and rolled my eyes at the lights going off and on. Early on in AEW, I'm like, we're still doing this after it's been just driven into the ground and it's just become such a dumb cliche that every booker does because they think it's cool because they remember it when they were younger or think it was super cool back then. And, you know, I think that's been overdone. And to me, the escape, the cage is bad, but the crash pad landing where the announcers have to sell that it looks like it hurt, and I'm not saying I want to do it, and I'm not saying you can't get hurt, but clearly it was set up. It's a crash pad under some flimsy corrugated steel tiles. And to me, if you're going to have a blood and guts match and hit each other with weapons and bleed, just keep it simpler and have the match end because of wrestling moves, holds, and weapons inside a cage with a lid on it. Stick to the gimmick. And I thought they just overbooked it and went too far, and it took away from the match for me.
No, I think that's completely fair. I would have preferred the match conclude in the ring myself. I think the point about, you know, MJF doing it just because he's cruel, it does have some merit. But I guess I was thinking from the perspective of 6 or 8 weeks from now, is anybody going to remember why he shoved him off the top of the cage? Probably not. It's just going to be the replay of the moment, and that'll be what's in the video packages. And so I thought it would have been a more cohesive story had they remained in the ring, or if it had finished on the shock and awe of the shoves. But I definitely can see your points. There's certainly bits of and pieces of the match that I think they sacrificed to the TV format, and also because they really wanted the finish to focus on Jericho and MJF exclusively, they kind of cut out, you know, the majority of the competitors for that last 5 or 10 minutes.
Yep. All right. Well, let's pause and introduce the show, and then we'll get to phone calls and emails. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. And I'm Wade Keller, the editor and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter, the website pwtorch.com, and host of this, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. Be sure to join us on our flagship edition tomorrow. PW Torch assistant editor Zach Haydorn joining me as co-host on the Thursday flagship this week. That's over on the Blue Logo Show. So search Wade Keller and subscribe to the Blue Logo Show. In addition to this, the Red Logo Show, they're both free. And they're ad-free and plug-free if you're a VIP member. pwtorch.com/govip gives you full information on getting ad-free episodes and a ton of bonus content. My co-host, the other voice you hear, is Jake Barnett from ProWrestling.net. Jake, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Wade. Always a pleasure to be here.
Always great to have you. We have our phone lines open, and we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. And we welcome you to give us a call or drop us an email. And when you call, if you call, push 1 on your keypad after dialing in. Did I say dial? After you touch tone in, whatever. Is that still dialing, Jake, if you don't dial? Like, do we say that?
I guess technically, yeah, in some way it is.
Yeah, okay. Well, then I withdraw my retraction. I don't know. But push 1 on your keypad. I know there's a keypad to indicate that you want to be on the show and flag us. All right, well, let's just get the calls. Let's get rolling, and we'll begin with Hinton calling from Canada. He is first up. Hinton, what do you think of the show tonight?
Hey, guys. Yeah, I thought it was a good show. I think you've covered all my points regarding the War Games match, and the callers probably have other stuff to say. I didn't think it was the best War Games match of all time. There's a couple in NXT I think I like better, but I wanted to talk about the two title scenes because that's sort of what I think is more discussed from this show. So little bit of a rant here. I thought Kenny's mic work was good tonight. First, I thought, you know, we can talk about that. He knew what he was going to say. He tried his best to get his two potential opponents over, but I don't think it made up for a lack of compelling challengers until he gets to Adam Page. Like, when I heard Tony Schiavone make the announcement that it would be Pac versus Orange Cassidy, I like, the air got out of me. I'm like, really? Is that a joke? Like, those are your top two right now? I mean, yeah. So here's the one scenario. We have Kenny Omega versus Pac, who Pac has had more face heel turns on a per-show basis than the Big Show, and not really a regularly featured singles act recently either. Or Kenny Omega versus Orange Cassidy, who Orange Cassidy just let Kenny Omega do whatever he wanted to him. Kenny Omega turned his back on him while making fun of him twice. He didn't throw a punch. He didn't do anything. I mean, imagine like Stone Cold or The Rock letting that happen to them. It just, I'm like, why are you standing there, dude? Like, there's so many openings he's giving you to just get back at him. But, and Kenny tried, like, he tried putting over Pac initially. He's like, yeah, I've lost to Pac before, you know. It made a meta sense, don't underestimate him. And then tonight they did the thing with Orange. They're trying hard. They're like, guys, we got to have this one match before we get to Hangman Page. Just kind of bear with us. But, I mean, I don't think it landed well for me. What are your guys' thoughts on it?
I thought this was maybe the first time in Dynamite history I felt like Kenny Omega gave a second of thought to what he was going to do before he showed up at the building that day, or put time into his promo before the promo started. And I don't know, I mean, give me an example if I'm wrong. Maybe I am. Maybe there's some other instance where it seemed like Kenny gave some thought to the promo ahead of time. So I applaud it. I mean, it sounds like a backhanded compliment, and in a way it is, but more of this where, you know, whether you like it or whether you think it was great or good or sloppy or amateur hour, at least it was Kenny talking and trying to develop his character and not just kind of acting like he's goofing off and has already arrived and has nothing to prove to anybody anymore. Which I think has been the vibe that he's given off at times, because, hey, I have a good match. I have a really good match every once in a while, and what else do you need? This was a long segment with a lot of bullet points. I think they gave away, and maybe they'll surprise me, but I think they gave away it's going to be Orange Cassidy. Kenny wanted Pac, or Pac, I guess we are settling on. He wanted Pac. He's like, he's beat me before. Bring him on. Let's announce the match. Now, I don't get why Kenny wants Pac, because I don't buy into the idea that Kenny's legitimately scared of Orange Cassidy. So I don't understand taking that approach or what the backstory is or rationalization is for Kenny wanting to face Pac instead of Cassidy. I think as fun of a story as Orange Cassidy is, and as credible and good as they've made him seem, he's not Pac. So I don't get why heel Kenny, who's listed the ways Pac has beat him before, wants Pac. I don't understand that. I need a backstory. So if someone can offer that, do it. Cassidy, though, I think has been built up enough where I'm intrigued by it. It feels early. Doesn't feel ripe, if you'll excuse the fruit pun. It doesn't feel ripe for Cassidy to be headlining a pay-per-view. I still think Cassidy, you think of the TNT title or maybe a title shot at the world title in a rare on television. Title defense. That said, I liked Cassidy's demeanor, and I'll push back, Hinton, on you saying that Cassidy, you know, can you imagine Stone Cold acting this way? Orange Cassidy is chill. I think, you know, he's just standing there with his hands in his pocket, basically saying, when the time comes, I'm taking notes and I'll get back at you, but I'm going to stand here and just put my effort where it counts, which is beating Pac next week and then beating you in the ring. I'm not going to react I'm not going to react to kind of the mind games you're trying to play here. So I had some good thoughts, some bad thoughts in terms of what they did and the way that they did it. But overall, it's a low bar, but I think it was Kenny's best promo to date. There was no Don Callis carrying things. Jake, I'm curious for your thoughts in general on the segment and what I had to say about it also.
No, I do think it was Kenny's best promo. I hope it's not Kenny's best promo that we see going forward, because I still think there's a lot for him to develop, particularly on the front of, sincerity is not the right word, but perhaps being a bit more comfortable in his own skin, because as much as it seemed like Kenny was working to to get through his bullet points and you know, make it very clear that he sees Orange Cassidy as being beneath him. I still think there was an element of, you know, this guy is clearly playing a character. You know, it never quite felt like he was living in the character. And so that was my takeaway, was Kenny has improved. He is improving. You know, the belt collector thing is something that works on a lot of, you know, of internet fans in particular, because I see people talking about it and they're excited about it on social media. But I don't think this was a performance that if you were somebody looking to be sold on Kenny Omega, that would make you think that he's must-see TV going forward. It just didn't have that magnetism or electricity of a guy who's really connecting with what he's doing. I hope Kenny, you know, kind of crosses that bridge and reaches that next level, because it's really what's missing at this point. He's fantastic in the ring, as everybody knows, and I think he has been working on improving his promo game, but he's just not at that elite level yet, in my opinion.
No, I agree, and I think the key is reps, and I've been talking about that in recent weeks a lot. Wrestlers need reps, and there's a lot of things in this pandemic era that they haven't gotten, and that live crowd feedback is one of them, but there's been a lot of great promo guys or interviews over the years, over the decades, who did all their great interviews in front of a camera in a studio, in a TV studio, or backstage. And, you know, guys can get reps in a variety of ways. That live crowd feedback, Kenny had some of it tonight and played off of it. But Kenny needs reps. If he does a promo like this, you know, every other week or throughout a 4 weeks, and if there's some stumbles, I mean, I wish he was doing heel promos since he won the title, since he turned heel. Heck, since Dynamite started, I wish he established a character other than, hey, I've got six-star matches and match of the year candidates and Hall of Fame awards and great matches in New Japan, so, you know, worship at my altar. I wanted to see him show up and take things to another level as a week-to-week TV wrestler in the United States, which is a whole different skill set, or a largely different skill set. And raise his game. And I think he'd be better prepared today had he done that. And he didn't for the first year. So here we are in May, deep into his title reign, and he's got work to do. But it's better doing work and not being perfect, or not having, you know, a firm footing on exactly what your character is and how to do it, and be trying. And it succeeded enough. I mean, I liked it. But he should be better by now. But he'll be better if he keeps doing this. Like you say, in 6 weeks or 12 weeks. So keep doing it and put thought into it. Come across as if you're hungry and you're adding to your game. Great NBA players spend the summer getting better at developing a new move, trying to get quicker, whatever it is, you know, the different skill sets to make themselves a better player the next year. Pro athletes do that. And Kenny's is in a position to do that and still get better, even at his age, with his reputation. So I hope this is a sign that he's actually stepping up and taking this seriously now in a way that I think he wasn't until this week. And like I said, I liked it, and I think he can build on this. But I thought somebody needed to be around to go, why is Kenny saying he wants to face Pac if he's going to pretend he doesn't know who Orange Cassidy is? Why are we supposed to believe he's scared of Orange Cassidy and would rather face Pac? Other than the contrivance of Cassidy's going to win, hopefully not because somebody interferes and costs Pac the match, but we'll see. Cassidy's going to win, and we want to make it seem like Kenny's scared of Cassidy. Right, well, I get that's the end point, but you got to tell the story to make it credible getting there. And I don't see that yet, so I hope we come up with it, but it would have been nice to have that somehow clear tonight. Jake, did that affect you at all?
Yeah, you know, I think there's bits and pieces of the Omega act where, you know, it's like he's got like eight out of 10 tools, like, you know, where it's just like, okay, if he can put all of it together, he's going to be, you know, at the top of pro wrestling. And I think you look at, and I'll compare him to, you know, to Roman Reigns in a way, where it's like we were waiting for him to finally like cement himself. And I think over the last 6 months, Roman has done that. You know, he is good enough in the ring to compete at an elite level. And he has, you know, captured, you know, some of himself in his character, and it's clicking. And I'm still waiting for Kenny Omega to do that. And as far as the whole Orange Cassidy and Pac situation goes. I'm still unsure of why they had Hangman Page lose to knock him off his perch as number one contender, so they could get to this point. It feels like they're getting close to the pay-per-view, and so they're starting to inch the pieces together. But Cassidy, you know, he hasn't really been involved anywhere near the main event recently, and neither has Pac, and they're trying to reintroduce those rankings. And as far as why Kenny would want to face the guy who had beat him previously, there's not a whole lot of logic there. And then he quickly, you know, kind of switched gears from pretending he didn't know who Orange Cassidy was to suddenly being able to explain everything there was to know about his gimmick and trying to put him over. And so there was, you know, some pieces of this that didn't quite flow 100% all in the same direction. But it was, at least from you know, the perspective of Kenny's promos, a step for him towards where he wants to go in the next couple of months, or, you know, the rest of this year.
Hinton, back to you.
Yeah, and just a couple of points to push back on regarding reps. That's a good idea. I would emphasize that not practice makes perfect, but perfect practice makes perfect. Like, he's actually got some sort of coaching. I know he's 38 or whatever, like, he needs someone that you can't just talk. Like, I talk, but I can't improve myself unless I'm consciously trying. Second of all, I don't think that he was meant to be scared. I don't think that was the story they were telling. I thought they were just trying to say he doesn't really think Orange is going to beat Pac. I like, he's just like trying to get to the chase. I think that was what they were trying to convey. And just to Jake's point, regarding Hangman Page, like, I don't think this was the right time to put Hangman Page in the main event. Like, I don't think this is the right time to have him remain number one contender. That is a longer story. They need to rebuild him. He needs to get through a couple of other opponents, get past the comedic Dark Order phase before he's actually presentable to Omega.
Jake, what do you think about those counterpoints from Hinton?
Well, I guess I'm of the opinion that Hangman Page is one of those guys that has all the tools. You know, I do enjoy his mic work. I think he's improved to the point where he's at the top of the promotion in terms of what he can do in the ring. I feel like they've been kind of circling the wagons with him for a long time now. You know, they had the tag team breakup, much earlier in 2020, and then it felt like they were starting to lay the foundation of telling the story of he and Kenny coming back together for this world championship, and then it was, delayed by the Dark Order and where they've gone with him recently, and so I would say that he, you know, maybe if there is a long-term story in motion there, then they should probably outline a plan for him at some point. I mean, I don't mind him not getting the title shot at the next pay-per-view, but if there is some long-term story in play, I think they got to touch base on it far more frequently than they do. Because right now it feels like he's a background character that occasionally gets involved in segments with factions that don't rise anywhere near the top of the card. So I guess to the other points, you know, it's all subjective. I completely understand where you're coming from. I don't have a bone to pick with a lot of what AEW has done thus far with Hangman. I think he's headed towards the top, and he'll get there eventually. I think he's that good that I'd like them to move a little bit faster.
Yeah, I'm with Hinton on. I'm okay with a slower build and waiting to the next pay-per-view. I think I just don't know if we're quite there yet, and I want there to be. I know, you know, they're going to sell, you know, Daly's Place out, but to me, for that pay-per-view, they're just going to, you know, have every seat available. But I want to see just like a regular arena, a fresh city, and a longer build. I think they've told such a long winding story with Paige. It just doesn't feel like they're on the cusp of him being the guy who would get the title shot. I just wish they had done a better job having Pac and Orange Cassidy come across, Pac just be on TV and winning singles matches, and Cassidy being portrayed and framed by announcing and the quality of opposition. And I think quality of opposition is a huge thing AEW needs to incorporate into their rankings and their discussions. I would have liked there to have been a defining win or two where they did sacrifice somebody who, you know, in a way that made it seem like, wow, okay, Cassidy's at that level. I don't think he's ripe for this level either. So they didn't have a lot of good choices. So we'll see what they do in the next few weeks to get us there. But this did feel premature. I do want to say I like Tony Schiavone's reactions to Omega. I thought he added to the segment, throwing his hands up, looking off camera when Kenny just started going off and you know, rambling about Pac and all that kind of thing. So I thought that added to it, and it gave Kenny someone to play off of a little bit too, which I think he needs. Well, that's in part why Nakazawa is there too. Anyway, Hinton, any closing words before I move on?
Yeah. Second topic I wanted to bring, and then I'll sign off. The TNT title scene. First of all, this is the first Dynamite I think since Sting's debut that we didn't see him.
good point.
And then we had the Ethan Page Scorpio Sky segment. So for a long time, for a few weeks, I've been apathetic toward these two. Most of what they do, most of their stories playing out on Dark, but their promo this week I actually quite enjoyed. I thought Scorpio Sky had a very simple critique of Sting's presence in the company, and Ethan Page's promo as well referred to history with Darby Allin, but then he acknowledges that, yeah, probably no one saw it, so let me tell you that, hey, face pain, I injured him, etc. I was like, all right, great, this is good. I hope you elaborate on this as the story progresses. And then they did that little angle in between. I'm like, all right, if you elaborate on this, I can get into an Ethan Page Darby Allin rivalry. And then I see later in the show, Miro, his promo made me do a bit of a mental U-turn. I'm like, all right, Miro cannot lose to Darby. Like, if he does, like, he has to beat him in a rematch or something. Like, this is Miro's only chance at escaping from that shadow of Kip Sabian. And, like, so now, I don't know how you reconcile the TNT title picture, because you have Ethan Page, you have Scorpio Sky, you have Miro, and you have Lance Archer. And then on the other side, you have Sting and Darby Allin. And they're all in this very convoluted feud together. What did you guys make of this?
Jake, I think Miro's going to beat Darby and be TNT champ. I think there may or may not be interference, or it'll just be Darby's hurt because of them, and that's what leaves him vulnerable. And then we got Sting and Darby against Sky and Ethan. I think they should drop Page from his name, by the way, because Ethan is distinctive. It fits his character. And I don't want to be overly sensitive like WWE is, but we have too many Cages and Pages. And I, even if there wasn't an Adam Page, I would be in favor of Ethan dropping the last name. Some people just, you know, some names just work, and I think he'd work with a single name. But that's a sidebar and not all that important. So I think we're headed to a tag match. Ethan and Scorpio against Sting and Darby, with Darby a former TNT champ, and then Miro as the new TNT champ. And I like Miro's promo. I think he's pivoted successfully from seeming like he was just in this to be self-indulgent and very specific in his topics in a niche-y way that I think just came across too cute and he just wasn't serious. And I get the sense he's serious now, and I actually get the sense he's threatening and formidable with his attitude and his intensity. I think he's genuinely intimidating now. I applaud this shift from him. Your thoughts on all that, Jake?
Yeah, I liked what Miro had to say. You know, he does seem like he's genuinely menacing. The fact that he was begging Darby to show up because he doesn't need anybody's handouts and he's going to beat anybody who stands in front of him, that was good. As far as the Scorpio Sky and Darby promo that led to the brawl, I thought it was okay. Scorpio Sky launching the promo with a line from one of the worst Batman movies was a little odd.
What did he say?
I think he said, riddle me this, riddle me
that.
That's
right.
He was afraid
of
the big black. It was like, okay, all right. That's all right.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then they kind of went really hard, like edgelord, like we're going to kill you kind of stuff. And that's always a little bit like you can't really keep that promise. And so I kind of shy away from promos that go to that level when he talked about killing Sting as being a good thing for the company. But You know, for the most part, I like their intensity level. I thought, you know, they probably could have done with some editing on the content in the promo, and it would have improved dramatically. I did like the brawl and the attack. I was a little surprised to see Darby go down a flight of concrete stairs. That could have gone wrong in any number of ways.
You were surprised to see Darby involved in something that could go wrong physically for him in a number of ways?
I mean, I guess there's a line there. I mean, there's no safety nets. It could have gone really bad. There was nobody there to do a catch or anything. So he's probably used to that from skateboarding, probably would be my...
His bump was way worse than what Jericho did. Not like... I'm not even saying in real life, but I am saying in real life, but just visually. I mean, to the fan base, Darby was the one who took the more dangerous fall in a mid-card stunt bump, not Jericho in a contrived fall off a roof onto a gigantic landing pad.
Yeah, so in terms of the direction, I think you're right. It's going to be Miro capturing that TNT title and Darby and Sting having a tag match. And I guess that it leaves Lance Archer on the outside looking in. Perhaps he's the challenger for the pay-per-view for the TNT title if Darby's not going to get an immediate rematch.
Yep, yeah, they've had Archer out there just in some of these angles, and it's been weird, you know, with Darby trying to figure out what's going on with it. So absent from this show like Sting, so we'll see how that all plays out. All right, Hinton, is there anything we didn't cover that you brought up?
No, I think that's good. Everyone go cool. VIP. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, appreciate it. All right. Our number is 347-215-8558. We'll move next to Derek in Utah, and then on deck is 804. Derek, thanks for calling. What'd you think of Dynamite tonight?
You know, I really wanted to like the Blood and Guts match, but you know, I thought they had a lot of problems with it tonight. You know, in a sense, it reminded me a lot of Kyle O'Reilly versus Adam Cole at the last TakeOver, where I thought they got off to a good start and laid a nice foundation for a good story. And then it just kind of died. And I remember looking at my clock at the last commercial break, thinking that there was maybe, you know, like, got to build up to this epic conclusion. I was like, there is 15 minutes left. The ring is completely apart. And there is absolutely no sympathy on the babyface team right now at all. And it kind of drove me nuts because you brought up the fact that about the blood. The excessive blood. And the people who were bleeding, who all the sympathy was on, were the heels. And until like that final stanza at the top of the cage when they were trying to build high drama, I didn't think the baby faces were in jeopardy, with the exception of Sammy Guevara in the first 7 minutes. That was kind of the only time that I thought the baby face team was even in jeopardy. You had almost 30 minutes of them up. And I just don't know if that's, like, the best way to build drama for a heel versus face grudge to settle the score, you know. So I thought that was a major issue. And then I thought you said it nicely. Like, if you were to write a script on what the finish was, where the babyface team, they sacrificed losing the match because they love their leader, and the heel throws the leader off anyways after the match, that sounds like it's dramatic, and that sounds meaningful, and that sounds like it would be a big moment. But when they were on top of the cage, I don't know if it was the camera views or me wanting to see what was happening inside when they were completely focusing on the top, but I just felt it was void of any real drama or escalation. And so when Sammy said, "I quit," I was like, well, it's over. And it was kind of a hollow feeling. And then I knew he was going to throw him off the top. So when that happened, and as you mentioned, the land on the crash pad looked as cheesy as Shane McMahon doing it 15 years ago. And I thought technology had come far, but apparently not so much. And it just kind of, I feel let down. I guess that's the best way to describe my feeling in my gut about the match.
Jake, what do you think about the psychology of the match and what Derek brings up in terms of who was bleeding and where the sympathy was, and then anything else he brought up too?
Yeah, I think there was enough blood all around that it kind of got – it ran together in a way for me. But I'm, you know, I'm transcripting the show, and so I may have missed some of the finer drama points there. But it did seem like the Inner Circle – dominated, you know, the bulk of the action, and in particular the FTR guys, you know, they wanted to go basically ear to ear with the Blade for this match, and they were bleeding all over the place, and that certainly did, you know, make them sympathetic figures. And as far as the hostage finish, the part about the hostage finish that, you know, now that I've had a few more minutes to think about it, that kind of bugs me is that why did Sammy Guevara trust MJF that he wasn't going to push him off anyway? Like, they've established in the story that Sammy was the least likely guy to take the bait. He saw through him from the beginning, right? And so to have him be the one that surrendered, thinking that he could prevent Jericho from being shoved off, just doesn't really jive with me either. So there's a couple of pieces of this that obviously in hindsight, you know, took away from the drama. But, you know, I respect the effort the wrestlers gave. But, yeah, there was definitely some pieces of this match that were reminiscent of that Cole and O'Reilly match, because I think the last 10 minutes or so, particularly coming back from a commercial break and then going to another one quickly, and then when they came back, they were kind of going into that final sequence on top of the cage, and it didn't feel like anybody else mattered anymore until the surrender. So they, when they do this again, hopefully they're able to do it on pay-per-view when they can tell a more complete story that isn't quite as disjointed because of those commercials.
All right, very good. Derek, anything else you want to bring up or follow up on?
I'm just kind of surprised, given Chris Jericho, how long he's been in the wrestling business, where I think, like, one of the big differences you see between tenured wrestlers and between newer wrestlers is newer wrestlers kind of focus the matches on big spots and big transitions, while a lot of more tenured wrestlers, they'll focus the match on telling a more complete story with a babyface working from behind, overcoming obstacles, some meaningful, very meaningful transitions that move into a babyface comeback or a
what
transition
you do between moves.
Exactly. When, yeah. I think what's kind of lost when sometimes when I watch AEW is, you know what, people are going to, when they talked about the Britt Baker match or when they talk about this match, they're not going to focus on the story. They're focusing on two or three big spots, and they're not. And I think that is great, but that's only part of the art of pro wrestling, and that's not the art of storytelling in pro wrestling. And I think that was missing in this match. And they would try to say that there was storytelling in the final stanza, but all of the groundwork that you laid for the drama of Chris Jericho being thrown off the top, I think was just lost in that 15 to 20 minutes of the Inner Circle beating the hell out of the Pinnacle and nobody trying to get anybody to quit at all. Because that was in the entire match, 45 minutes. There was only one sequence, and it was at the top of the cage at the very end, where anybody was actually trying to get somebody to surrender. And I think, were they trying to win? Like, did you sense that they were trying to win in the after all the guys were in the ring? Or was it, maybe I missed it, but I didn't sense anybody was really trying to win.
Jake, what'd you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't recall any other submission attempts other than, I think Jake Hager applied an ankle lock at one point prior to the point where anybody could actually submit. And I think it was, gosh, I'm trying to remember who he applied it on, but they tapped out, but it had no effect on the outcome of the match.
Before, I think it was Sean, everybody was
Sean
that, yeah.
Spears, I think it yeah. was actually. But the, yeah, once it became a brawl, it was mostly, you know, just about revenge and inflicting as much damage as possible. I mean, there were points where I think Jericho was you know, choking someone with a bat, and then they were beating on someone with that turnbuckle clamp, and it drew blood, but there was never any point where anybody was asking for them to surrender or calling for the ref to ask for a surrender or anything like that. So, yeah, it really did lack some drama in that middle kind of act of the match.
Cool. Derek, anything else you want to add?
And I think it's as simple as, you know, we're talking about guys beating each other up. How meaningful would it have been if they would have made somebody quit when they threatened to hit him with the spike or the fork and then have the other team cut that guy off? But there was none of that. Or applying a submission hold when the guy's on the verge of tapping out and then the baby faces come in to make a save. That's drama. That's how you have a false finish in a match that doesn't have pins. And that was not, like, that wasn't crafted at all in the match.
Yeah.
And these are smart wrestlers. So what were they going for? We're going to bleed all over the place to shock people? Great. Great.
Yeah, I do. I think they're preoccupied with living up to the name of the match. You know, blood and guts and gore. And it feels a bit like hot-shotting in the sense of we've got this audience, we want to – this match has been planned for a while. It's not in reaction to last week's numbers by any means, but this constant desire to use a hot shot tactic on occasion, but regularly try to do something shocking like the Britt Baker match and her bloody faces in the opening to Dynamite Now, at the expense of, I think, sort of quality control and having someone asking questions or having storylines where in match. The drama within a match where you can kind of explain things. And to me, having Orange Cassidy more prepared to be announced by Schiavone as one of the top two contenders to get a pay-per-view world title match, as rare as those are in AEW, to me, that's way more important than a stunt bump at the end of a War Games that just did not need a stunt bump. This is trying to relive Mick Foley. And I just think the audience is craving something more sophisticated and less excessive. And I think they could have gotten away with doing 30% less from a violent standpoint, kept it in the ring, and done some of the things you brought up, Derek, specifically in the lead up to all the men being in the ring so that a match could end, and then having a finish that was more of a callback to something earlier in the match or another War Games. And it felt like too much. The thing about Tony Khan's booking that I wish in a real broad stroke that was different is I wish it didn't feel like it was sort of, I was listening to a classic Attitude Era radio station, and that it was more forward leaning. And I don't mean catering to a niche of a niche internet, social media feedback loop, where they understand every reference Excalibur makes. I think there's another option out there, and it's doing something new, not being a best of rock station or a best of Attitude Era station. And I think that's what Tony Khan grew up with, and I think he thinks we got to counter-program WWE in the PG era. I think they're a little more preoccupied with that than is prudent, and I think it's limiting them. And it's just making the product not as sophisticated and complete and satisfying as it could be. Jake, any thoughts on that? And then I'll go back to Derek for any final words, and then we got to get to a lot of callers.
Yeah, no, I think what you touched on there makes it's something that dawned on me watching, you know, Tony Khan make comments about. Just recently he made one about how he wants to ensure that there's clean finishes because the other show does a lot of, you know, interference finishes or non-finishes. And it's like I think what AEW should seek to do, and maybe, you know, this is a direction they're already heading, and it's just not something they're publicly commenting on, but you know, they should be focused on finding a median between doing what the competition does and doing what's best for their show. Because, you know, in the opening match of this show with the tag match between, you know, Moxley and Kingston and Omega and Nakazawa, we got a clean finish, but I think the consequence of that was we had to do yet another post-match beatdown, and we see that all the time on this show. And I think that you can go so far in the other direction that you become just as predictable and just as lacking in creativity as your competition. So I hope they move away from that. And I think there's a lot of other discussion points that you could probably bring up in that same vein. But obviously, you said we have a lot of callers to get to, so I'll end there.
Sure thing, Derek. Any closing words?
Yeah, just the kind of my closing thought is, I think what distinguishes garbage wrestling from pro wrestling is, a lot like Mick Foley is a great example of a guy who told great stories using weapons to build sympathy and drama, which is not garbage wrestling. Garbage wrestling is when you do violence for the sake of violence. And mostly I thought, not all the match, but a lot of it, and why I'm disappointed is these are not garbage wrestlers in any way, shape, or form. But a good half of this match was void of storytelling and hence would be considered garbage wrestling to me. So you guys have a good night, and I'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Derek. Great call. Really appreciate you providing all those perspectives. All right, our number 347-215-8558. Push 1 if you want to join us now or any future show. We're live after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown at WadeKellerPostShow.com. We've got links in my TV reports on Monday night, Wednesday night, and Friday night for Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown at the top and bottom of the report. There's the phone number, a link to the specific show page for that night's show, and also our email address so you don't have to memorize anything. If you're not going to listen to the live stream, but you want to contribute your thoughts, that's what the email is for. And it's Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. So that's the best way to do things. You can subscribe to our podcast. It's free, and you can get all our shows. We have a blue logo show and a red logo show. The red logo show are our live call-in post shows and our best of post shows. And the blue logo show are more traditional podcasts, pre-recorded, post-produced, interviews, roundtables, our flagship, and pay-per-view previews, that kind of thing. So subscribe to both. They're free. Just search Wade Keller on your podcast app, and both logos should pop up or available pretty much everywhere. And also always find links to our shows at our main website, pwtorch.com. All right, so as I noted, we'll go to 804 next, and then on deck we'll go to 781. 804, thanks for calling. Go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Ashley. I'm calling technically from Virginia, but I actually went to the show tonight, so in Orlando right now.
Awesome. Oh, great, great.
For
yeah, good to get an in-person perspective. Yeah, thank you for calling, Ashley.
Yeah,
what'd you think?
Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay? Sorry, I had you connected to my ex-car.
Yeah, I don't know if your Bluetooth is always a little iffy. If you're talking directly into the phone, it's better, but you sound fine.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much for taking
yeah.
my call. I will, yeah, I'm about to pull over, but thank you so much for taking my call. I was actually calling, the previous caller just kind of cleared it up, because I actually had a question for you guys as well, because we actually weren't sure what the exact finish was for the main event when we were in person, because we were all focused on, you know, MJF and Chris Jericho on top of the cage. We actually missed what happened in the ring. So just to clarify,
oh, wow.
Sammy was the one who submitted. He gave up to pretty much save Chris Jericho. Is that what happened there?
Jake, like you, I'm typing up the report if it happens, but I think it was Sammy who yelled up and said, "We surrender," right?
Yeah, he ended up on the outside of the cage yelling up at the referee that he surrendered on behalf of the team because he didn't want Jericho to get thrown from the top of the cage. And that's when they called the match. But then after the match was officially over, MJF shoved Jericho off. I'm not sure if that all played out live, if it made sense to you. It's difficult in the building sometimes to keep up on those things.
That is not a good thing, Ashley. If you're in the building and you don't know what happened, and that might explain what to me felt through television as a bit of a letdown live among the audience. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you guys were aware. We were actually about 7 minutes before the show actually started. Tony Khan came out and said that the first hour of the show was going to be a cinematic approach. And they had actually taped all the matches earlier in the day. So the first hour, up until Kenny Omega came out, His interview with Tony Schiavone and Orange Cassidy, everything was just pre-recorded, and we were just watching it on the screen. So at first, everyone was kind of bummed about that. But Tony was actually really cool about it. He was like, you know, if anyone's too upset, they have the option to go get a refund within like the next 45 minutes. But everyone stayed, of course. But we were just kind of bummed about that because we were looking forward to seeing Cody and everything. I'm sorry?
Yeah, let me clarify that.
Yeah.
What part of the show did you not see as an audience member starting at 8 Eastern?
Yeah, so we saw everything. So pretty much like the first hour, we were just watching it on the big screen. So like all the matches.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Pretty much everything until Kenny Omega came out and did the interview with Orange Cassidy and Tony Schiavone. That was the first time we had seen anyone besides Tony Khan, who when he came out to give the announcement before the show. That was the first time we had seen anyone come out.
Did you know that, Jake?
No. In fact, they had advertised this as being live heading into the show. And so I wasn't aware that they had taped anything in advance. So they actually had crowd noise during the matches on the TV broadcast. So that must have actually been baked in from
Did they pre-tape it? What I'm wondering is, did they pre-tape it last week, Ashley? And then only the last part of the show was live. I guess I got to get clarification on that.
Yeah, some people around had said that they had heard from some like crew members that they were taping stuff earlier in the day, I'm not sure because once they put the cages down, they couldn't raise them, so that's why the first hour we just pretty much watched it on the big screen until Kenny came out. So that's why another reason we were hyped for the match too, but everyone was so excited because that was the first time for the main event that we were actually seeing a match. So that was kind of interesting. I was a little bummed by that, but the experience itself is just so fun. You know, you kind of give it a pass. But and me and my friend were talking, if this was a WWE thing, like everyone would have been crapping on it in a completely different reaction. But that was an interesting little tidbit there.
That makes sense. It was the logistics of building the War Games double cage that prevented them from being able to do a regular show otherwise. Now, if they had three rings, they could have had the War Games set up and then a third ring next to it. You know, I mean, that could have been an option, so they could at least have been live. It was weird when the announcers talked, Jake, about this is the largest crowd we've had since New Year's 2020, and they never showed the crowd. Like, you know, they didn't go out of their way to show the crowd more until Kenny stood in front of the stage, and that explains the setting of the interview, too. Interesting, yeah. I'm glad you called and let us know that, Ashley. That makes sense why they did it now. You know, at least, you know, they couldn't build a cage and have it done quickly and securely.
Right. Yeah, it does make total sense, especially because when we got in there, we were like, well, that's odd. Like, are they going to start off the show with the main event? You obviously wouldn't do that. So when Tony came out, he came out, like, right at, like, 7:54, 7:55. And he was really, like I said, Tony, like, the one thing about him, and I think the main difference between, like, if this was, like, if WWE had done the same thing, for instance, compared to AEW, is just with things, you know, like, for instance, with tonight's finish where it wasn't really that clear, or, you know, things in the past with, like, the death match and stuff, like, I think we're all just still kind of forgiving with AEW because Tony Khan plays a big factor in that. Like, he's so fan friendly, like he just gives you that vibe, like he's so appreciative. And he came out after the show as well and thanked us all again for being there. So we were the best crowd since since everything happened. And he just really appreciated it. And then just said something about like ticket deals for next week's show if he came tonight. But Tony just really, he really just makes it like, just put that like smooth touch on everything. He just really makes a big difference there. So ideally we would have wanted to see everyone, of course, but he definitely helps things out there.
So talk about the ebb and flow of the crowd reaction, Ashley, during it's War Games. Blood and Guts. How did it work? Did it seem too long? Where was the peak audience interest? I know there's confusion about the finish, but just did it work from a live experience? Setting aside, if you can, to a degree, we love everything because it was just great to be there and it was so cool. You know, like, I get that there's some kind of goodwill there from, like, we're back and it's live and it's a amazing match, but did it work in terms of the various ways they could have paced it? What were the strengths and weaknesses of the length and duration and ebb and flow?
It definitely, there were some spots where it, I don't want to say dragging's not the right word, because it was a good match, I guess, but there were definitely some points where it was like, people were like kind of checking the time to see like what was going on, especially when they started tearing the ring up. And I'm sorry, you guys may have touched on this before. I kind of chimed in a little late in the show. But like once they started ripping the ring apart, and with the baby faces were just so like the Inner Circle, when they were just so dominant, we're like, is it really going to end like this? Are they going to drag it out? Because there was still a good amount of the show left. So everyone was just kind of like intrigued, not like, it was not hanging on every move, but just trying to see, like, how we get to the end. And then once MJF and Escape the Cage, we kind of figure out what was going to happen there. But it was, I would say everyone was pretty engaged for the most part. And like I said, everyone was just so stoked to be there that they really didn't care. And even within the first hour, I was talking to one of my friends. It's amazing because everyone was reacting to the moves on the screen like it was happening in the ring, like still like cheering for Cody and just like counting, you know. It's just, so it was still like, I don't want the perception to be out there. It was still a good time. It just, of course, you would have preferred to see it live, but it was still definitely a good time. And really, quick, Britt Baker, I'm not sure. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say really quick. I'm sure you guys have touched on this as well, but Dr. Britt Baker is a star, and that's actually one of the questions that I wanted to ask you guys as well. Do you guys see her for sure winning the title from Sheeta? And do you think she's going to turn, or is she going to stay heel? Because I would say she got the best reaction besides John Moxley and Kenny Omega tonight.
Yeah, no, we haven't talked about her yet, and I'm glad you brought her up. I love that use of a squash match. I like a mix of match lengths. I like when somebody just gets a showcase where the announcers talk about her. It's about her signature moves. It's about her ring entrance. It's about her attitude. You get in and out 3-4 minutes, boom, you've accomplished something. And it's just a break from the heavier matchups with more even that had a lot of buildup and that go longer. So just a generic applause for the squash match format. Jake, I'm curious, and I'm sure everybody, I think everybody should be curious about how crowds react to wrestlers after not having had a chance to react to them. Promoters have been flying blind for over a year now in terms of who they're pushing and how they're pushing and how wrestlers are acting. It sounded like, and actually I'll throw back to you on this in a minute, regarding MJF's reaction and the crowd reactions for the various heels and faces otherwise. But is Britt Baker, Jake, going to get cheered everywhere? And would that cause you to turn her face sooner? Or do you just say, we got to shift how she acts as a heel, have stronger baby faces, and ride out Baker being a heel for another year or two? Because if they do that, my argument would be her eventual baby face turn would mean so much more. She has a longer run as a heel, and they just work hard to get her booed, in part by building up strong faces.
Yeah, I think they have enough faces on the roster for her to work with that it would be a bit awkward if she turned. Like right away, I know she is getting some cheers, but I think she's progressed enough and she's talented enough on the microphone to where she could definitely, you know, get some heat with crowds if that's the direction they're going over the next couple of months, is bringing in more live fans. Because you have obviously Sheeta as competition as a babyface. You have Riho, you have Penelope Ford, you have Thunder Rosa, you have Chris Statlander, you have quite a few, Conti and others would fit that role as well. But I think she has more opponents as a babyface than she would as a heel, at least people that would fit right into to having title matches. I think Serena Deeb is going to be returning soon as well. And so there's definitely some tread on the tires from that perspective of having a good long run as a heel champion, if that's the direction they want to go with Britt. And I completely agree. She's a standout in terms of personality, and I think she's improved dramatically in the ring since AEW has launched. And so I think she's primed and ready for a title run.
All right, Ashley, back to you. Talk about the crowd reactions for various wrestlers, if anything else surprised you.
Yeah, everyone hates MJF, and it was so refreshing to see, because I was kind of curious just to see what reaction he would get live in person, I guess obviously from my perspective as well, being there, just because I didn't know if it was going to be – I kind of thought it may be like I was kind of likening it to Roman Reigns, where since we're finally able to like boo Roman Reigns, if the fans at WrestleMania, for instance, like we're gonna end up cheering him because we're so happy. But no, everyone hates MJF. Everything that guy does, no one can stand, and they were calling like chanting a-hold towards him at any chance that they could. And before, I'm not sure, after the Pinnacle came out, did they go to like a commercial break or anything before Inner Circle came out? Or did they just go straight to Inner Circle after that? Okay.
Yep, there was a break.
That's what I figured, because that's what I thought. Because the Pinnacle, they were really, like, really going after the crowd. Like he was going to throw a chair. One of them threw, like, water into the crowd. Like, MJF was just acting like – MJF was, like, trying to go after the crowd. He was just really – like, they were all just, like, hamming it up. But MJF the most, like, he got the most reaction. And after everything kind of died down right before Inner Circle came out, that's when everyone started chanting A-hole towards him. So I think if they keep on this path with him, he's going to be something big as well.
Jake, do you have any questions for Ashley, having attended?
I'm curious what the live crowd reaction was to Kenny Omega's promo. I know we had talked about it a little bit earlier on the show, but it didn't sound like you had heard that part of the conversation. But I was, you know, when you watch it on TV, it's obviously a very different impression that you get live. Was there more electricity in the building when Kenny was talking than what came through on TV? I guess that's what I'm wondering.
Especially given that the audience hadn't seen wrestlers in person up until then.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, I'm not sure if it was maybe tainted by that as well, just because we were so excited to see like that first star come out. But everyone was chanting his name. Everyone was chanting Kenny's name. I'm not sure if you guys heard that, but pretty much like the whole upper section was chanting for him. We were just like so excited to actually, because we didn't think he was going to come out since he had that pre-taped match earlier in the show. So we didn't expect him to come out at all. So it was fun to see him. But yeah, they're still very much cheering for him, which I guess is not really what you want right now, since he's supposed to be a heel, but he's still way over as a babyface. I'm sure that they could definitely tweak him back over there if they wanted to. Not that I'm saying they should, but Kenny he still has that star feel to him as well.
Ashley, what else do you want to bring up from attending the show?
It was so much fun to actually be able to go back in. It's just, again, just like everything AEW does, like they gave out like free posters and stuff too. It's just a completely different vibe than WWE. And I've been going to WWE shows for 15 plus years. And in AEW, I went to the first DC show as well. And just every show that you go to that they put on, it's just like you feel included there. And like you feel like it's okay to cheer and like they want you to be included. So it's just that atmosphere hasn't changed. So that's refreshing. But I was just mainly wondering about the ending of the show and just to thank you guys for your time. And just Wade, thank you to you too. I've been VIP for about 6 months or so. So just like everyone said, heel Wade, I think it's what you go. Yeah, you on the fix with Todd. That's one of my main go-tos during the week. So that's been helping me get through like these past few months. So between that and the after show with Mike McMahon and Andrew Socek, I hope I said that right. I did that show as well. So just thank you guys and Jake as well, everything you do at ProWrestling.net. It's just, we appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Ashley. Please call again, not just when you attend. We'd love to hear from you again.
Yeah, I definitely will. Thank you guys for your time.
You bet. All right. Well, it's cool to have an on-site correspondent again, Jake. It's been a year. It's been over a year to have somebody who attended the show. And I should note, for newer listeners or people who have just sort of forgotten, when shows start up again, including Dynamite, let us know ahead of time if you're attending the show. Include your phone number, and you can call us whenever it works for you after the show ends. I'll look for your phone number on the switchboard, and we can bring you on for an on-site correspondence segment. You'll leap ahead in line once you email and let us know that you're ready for us. And you can email wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. That applies to Raw, SmackDown, and AEW Dynamite, and also I'm sure the NXT crew on Tuesday nights. We'd love to hear from you also if you're attending NXT shows at Capital Wrestling Center and can give that in-person perspective. All right. Let's move to our next caller here. As noted, Bryant in Boston is up next. Go ahead, Bryant, what's in your mind about tonight's show?
Hi, Wade. Hi, guys. You can hear me okay, right?
Yeah, yep, you sound great.
Oh, okay, yeah, just want to make sure.
Yeah, you know, we'll talk for 2 minutes and then we're like, hello.
Yeah. I want to thank Ashley for bringing that Tony Khan bit 5 minutes before the live show about how it was taped and everything and how the crowd had to watch for basically the first hour, because that I mean, granted, Tony Khan and AEW are able to get away with stuff like that, you know, because Tony Khan's generally comes off as a nicer guy than Vince McMahon. Because, I mean, I'm not going to throw any bones here because, not pull any punches, but Vince McMahon to me has turned into a bad guy who doesn't care about his wrestlers, and he has a lot of blood on his hands with drugs and everything and the brutal travel schedule he's had in the past. So Tony Khan compares pretty favorably to him because he seems like he actually cares about his wrestlers. But that's kind of besides the point. But, I mean, if you're going to advertise a live show and stuff and, you know, like the cage logistics get in the way of that, you want to make sure you let the crowd know that before, like really well beforehand instead of 5 minutes before the show, because that's bad for business. And, you know, the crowd might be forgiving, but other crowds might not be so much in the future. So that's probably something you want to avoid in the future. That's not a good thing to do. But
I wonder if you weighed the options of announcing that on social media and on their website ahead of time, you know, like, or if you worried that people wouldn't show up or that people wouldn't watch the show because they would
I get that, but it's a dumb move to spring that on your live crowd 5 minutes beforehand. That's not going to sit well with people. I mean, maybe the crowd was forgiving of it, but if it becomes more of a pattern. But anyway, I'll get to my thoughts on the actual show. Kenny Omega, I thought, was the star of tonight. I mean, the Blood and Guts match, I fast-forwarded through most of it because, well, I'm not really – because I wanted to call you guys, and, the Blood and Guts match was really boring, and I didn't really like it that much, because it was just such a non-conclusive ending. I mean, you at least want to have an ending where, you know, somebody taps out or somebody gets pinned. I mean, just like a surrender like that, it was stupid. It really made MJF shine as a star and really built him going forward as a main eventer. But other than that, the match really did nothing for me. So I didn't really like it too much. It was like that previous caller, I think Derek was, said it was mainly garbage wrestling. And one thing I didn't like was that MJF and Jericho were fighting on top of the cage, they completely ignored the action at the bottom in the actual cage itself, which I don't think is a good thing, but as I was saying before, Kenny Omega was the star of this show. I mean, his promo was great. I mean, that's the first time they really let him have extended mic time. And I'm glad Don Callis wasn't out there for a change because, you know, that kind of gets old after a while. But Omega was great. He came across with the heel mannerisms. He completely buried Orange Cassidy, and let's be honest, it was deserved because Orange Cassidy really has no business being in a number one contenders match, in my humble opinion. I mean, and the way he built up Pac was pretty good. I mean, he was great. I thought that's definitely the best promo I've seen from him. I mean, I don't know what his promos were like in New Japan, but he was spectacular, and he really built himself up. I mean, I have to say, having Orange Cassidy involved in the world title picture is just stupid. I mean, he's not main event level material. In my opinion, he never will be. He doesn't have, I mean, I probably weigh more than him, to be honest. And he's, I don't know.
Half the audience does, but.
He's over with the crowd, but just because somebody's over doesn't mean they're necessarily big material. I mean, Daniel Bryan has sort of the same crowd following, but the thing is, he can actually wrestle. Cassidy's not really all that good, to be honest, and Bryan can cut a promo, but Omega was great, and he really established himself as a heel. I really look forward to what he has going ahead. That was my main point, and I'll just kind of address a couple of other minor points, and then I'll hang up and let you guys talk about it, because I know you got other callers, so I'll just make it as fast as I can. The women's Britt Baker's great, and I hope they put the title on her at Double or Nothing, and I tend to think they will. But you know, knowing Omega's history of booking the women's division, I wouldn't be surprised if they had Sheeta win, which in my opinion would be stupid. Sheeta's been the champion for give or take about a year at this point. Her time's up. It's time to have somebody new come in, and Baker should be the champion. I mean, she's vastly improved her wrestling. Her promo skills are great. And I actually disagree with you guys on her being a heel, on being like a hard heel or a face in terms of her, in turn, if she does win the title, because back when, what was it, like 2017 or 2018, when Becky Lynch turned on Charlotte and became heel and eventually won the title, she was technically a heel, but she basically was gray for most of her title run, and the crowd was behind her. And I just think with Britt Baker, she could just kind of, I think she could sort of do like a sort of gray thing where, you know, she acts heelish, but, you know, kind of panders to the crowd a little bit. So I think she could weave a sort of gray line and be just fine with the fans. So I don't think she necessarily needs to be a heel or a face per se. So she's great in my opinion. I hope they put the title on her. And my last point, and then I'll hang up. I'm sick and tired of the Good Brothers on AEW. They work for a different company with Impact, you know, and I watch Impact myself, probably one of the few AEW fans who actually do, but they got their own time on Impact. They've been overexposed for a long time. Their run-ins are getting sick and tired. I mean, if Kenny Omega and the Bullet Club are going to be reconstituted, it should have been just him and the Bucks beating the crap out of Kingston and Moxley. Just bringing in the Good Brothers every freaking week, it's annoying, not valuable heat. It's go-away heat. It makes me want to change the channel heat. The Good Brothers, they belong in another company. Just keep them off the TV screen for a couple weeks and then bring it back on again. And that just kind of feeds into my larger point with the refs. I mean, other than Aubrey Edwards and maybe Bryce Remsburg to an extent, JR said early in the tag match, is this a Texas Tornado match or something? Because the ref came off looking like an absolute idiot, Paul Turner. I mean, he was doing nothing to try to keep the heels and the faces, the illegal men out of the match. And I just think they need to, and also during the QT Marshall and Cody Rhodes match, QT Marshall blatantly hit Cody Rhodes with a belt, which should be a disqualification. And then, Arn Anderson physically attacked QT Marshall after being attacked himself. That should have been another disqualification. I mean, if they're going to pull stuff like that, at least say in advance, you know, we give our refs like some discretion and stuff, you know, so it doesn't, you know, so they don't disqualify things right away. But if it escalates, they will. But the refs just look like idiots most of the time, and that needs to stop. They need to do a better job, like, keeping the tag matches from being chaotic. So anyway, that's my main point. Overall, I thought it was a good show, and I'll let you guys get to the next call and maybe discuss my points a little bit. Anyway, thanks, and have a good night.
Sure. Thanks, Brian. Jake, respond to any of that.
Yeah, I guess in regards to the post-match attack with the Good Brothers at the start of the show, I think that feeds into a larger issue that AEW has around match finishes that I kind of touched on a little bit earlier. Rather than, you know, going down the road of doing some kind of disqualification or a count out or something of that nature with, you know, with outside interference getting involved in the match, they'll do a finish and then they immediately go to some kind of post-match attack or beatdown that was clearly premeditated. And I think it's a noble thing to want to give your audience finishes to matches, and I don't necessarily disagree with that being the default inclination, but I don't know that it needs to be 100% of the time. I mean, I think 80% of the time is fine, but I think we get into the, when it makes sense, it works, but when, you know, there are times when it doesn't make sense to do a clean finish, and I think a lot of times AEW does it anyway, and then they have to do pre- or post-match, setups in order to get there. And so I agree that, you know, I don't necessarily think the Good Brothers are a problem necessarily. I mean, I'm not particularly enthused about a reformed Bullet Club either. But I think they're just used as a part of Kenny Omega's, you know, group of people, whether it's, you know, Cutler and Nakazawa, the Bucks, and or the Good Brothers. You know, they're just the people that are kind of floating in his orbit at the moment to facilitate his heel tactics, whatever they happen to be, week to week. And I guess on the Britt Baker front, I don't see a lot of parallels between her and Becky Lynch. I think Becky was so successful and beloved as a babyface that WWE just had a really hard time turning her heel, and it's not what the fans wanted for her. And I think she pivoted to a gray character because she basically established a completely new identity, post that turn on Charlotte and became the man character. I think it's a pretty far cry from where Britt Baker was as a babyface, where she was just the wrestling dentist who reminded us of her dentistry every time she was out there, and people just kind of generally rejected it. I think she's found her stride as a heel, and I think that lends to a successful babyface turn at some point. But I have yet to see AEW really pull off a successful tweener type character, and I don't know if I'd necessarily roll the dice on Britt being the first person to break that mold. But yeah, I guess that's all I can think of at the moment to respond to.
Okay, I got distracted while you were talking, Jake, so I had to tend to something else. So I'm going to go to our next caller and thank Brian for all of his thoughts. All right, so let's move on here to we'll go to Craig in Toledo. Is up next. Craig, thanks for calling. What do you think of Dynamite tonight and any of our conversation so far?
I thought it was good. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello? Okay. Yeah, I thought it was a good show for what I saw. I was really distracted working for most of it. But I thought the end, like you at the beginning of the show, pretty much explained exactly what I thought of it. Like, I'm like spot on with you. I don't really have many other thoughts on the other stuff because, like I said, I was distracted. But the thing you guys haven't talked about was that Moxley and Yuji Nagata promo. And I thought that was really well done. And they used a lot of footage, which was really cool to see. And I'm really looking forward to that for next week. And other than that, you guys did a great job. And it was awesome hearing the live correspondent again. It was like,
I know,
kind of like a, whoa.
We made it.
That's like,
we made it.
Literally made it.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that.
You guys have a good night.
All right, Craig, thanks for hanging to contribute that thought. Jake, yeah, what'd you think of the hype video for next week's match and the way that they kind of framed who Nagata is and Moxley doing the heavy lifting in terms of the promo work and establishing, you know, what the backstory is and why this match is happening? People who think it's a big deal think it's a really big deal. Do you think it resonates with the majority of the AEW audience in a cool way, more so because of that video package now?
Yeah, I think they did a good job of hammering the point home with the limited time that they had to do so. And I think Moxley, you know, took a mile from basically the inch that Nagata gave him. You know, he focused on one word that he could take offense to and then blew that up into an entire promo about disrespect and, you know, how, you know, even at somebody's age like Nagata, he can still teach him something in the ring. And so I thought Moxley was, gave us another one of those, you know, master class promos where he just conjured something from nothing, so to speak. And I liked it. I think the Moxley of New Japan is almost cooler than the character that he plays in AEW these days. And so it's nice to see him sort of slide back into that you know, that old hat, so to speak, where he's the man and he's calling out his opponent, and he's not involved in a tag feud where his IQ shifts 100 points between, you know, television weeks. And so I like Moxley when he gets a chance to be a badass, and so this was a welcome change of pace for me.
Yes, yes. How was just Eddie Kingston as an act working, and how did that main event work for you in terms of Nakazawa being put in that spot?
You know, I'm not a huge fan of the way that they're using Cutler and Nakazawa at the moment. I think Nakazawa is fun as a comedy act, but I never take him seriously in the ring. And so to think he could get in there and compete with Kingston and Moxley is kind of laughable. And I wish we heard more from Kingston and Moxley as a team, honestly. They've been embroiled in this feud, and they only get, you know, 30 seconds or a minute to do a pre-tape or something from on a weekly basis. And so I think they've kind of faded into the background in a way that I wasn't expecting, and I think the program has been a little bit predictable in terms of the story beats from week to week. I hope they can get away from that. I assume that it's going to be Kingston and Moxley against the Young Bucks at some point for the tag titles, but I maybe that's the match for Double or Nothing once the Young Bucks clear the deck of SCU. But I guess we'll see what where that's going. But I think they have to try and get away from this mold and this pattern that they've been in of having matches that have no stakes and then post-match beatdowns and the two most street smart characters on the show in terms of Kingston and Moxley getting routinely outsmarted by heels that telegraph their tactics from 600,000 miles away. And so I think there's something that's been missing from that feud, and I hope they can get back to it and fill in the gaps.
All right. Very good. Let's go next to Sam in Nebraska. Sam, thanks for calling. What did you think of Dynamite and our conversation so far?
It was okay. I'm not generally a fan of like the War Games concept. I don't really have a lot of nostalgia for it. So match was what it was. I thought it was maybe a little boring. But I guess, I wanted to talk more about how they've built this really good-looking show for next week that I'm way more interested in than I was for tonight, being the really looking forward to the Yuji Nagata Moxley match, the Pac and Orange Cassidy match I absolutely loved from Revolution last year. What are your thoughts on, like, kind of doing – I mean, these are definitely two big weeks in a row. Do you think they should maybe be spreading those out a little more, or what are your kind of thoughts on that?
Jake, I don't think they're giving away too much 2 weeks in a row, and I think they are chasing down that second million. I think they don't want viewership to drop any more than it did last week. I mean, last week the rating pattern was 688,000 viewers the last time that they went head-to-head with NXT, and then they jumped to 1.219 million, and then they dropped not – alarmingly, to 1.104 million. Now it's 115,000 viewers. But it was such a high peak number 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. No big deal. But then last week it dropped under 900,000 up against the State of the Union from President Biden. So they have to wonder how much is it the Biden speech, which didn't do blockbuster ratings, but it was a big deal and it knocked them out of the normal demographic rankings. But they were the number two non-State of the Union show on cable that night, if I remember, maybe number three, I think number two. So in the 18 to 49 demo, they don't want to drop anymore. You know, they had a sense of we've got this audience, let's promote this match. And then when we have a big audience this week for Blood and Guts, which they've been promoting, I think effectively as a big deal for weeks and loaded up the show otherwise, they don't want them to go, okay, that was fun. Now let me know when there's another big show in a month or two. They want them to come back next week. So I think having a good follow-up is smart. I don't think it's too much. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think they have to load up these shows. You know, they're running unopposed to wrestling content week to week, and they are working on expanding that audience. I think they do want that next million viewers. And I don't think they need to follow WWE's storyline beats to get there. You know, it's not, you know, a situation where they need to tie themselves to, oh, we, you know, there's, I guess, you know, they do pay-per-views every 3 months, so that's 12 weeks. And so we have to do 4 weeks of a certain story, and then, you know, we move on to the next thing. And you know, they have the freedom to blaze their own trail. And if they want to work through this process by trying to continue to throw gas on the fire of these programs by having high-profile matches week to week, I think that's something that you have to do when you're young as a promotion and you're hungry and you're trying to build stars and you're trying to create stars and you're trying to attract an audience. You know, they probably see that 1.2 million number as, hey, we should be able to achieve this every week, and we need to program in a way that gets us back there. And I think they definitely have enough star power on the show to do it. It's just a matter of effectively using it. And so I'm all for them loading up these shows as much as possible.
All right, Sam, back to you.
Yeah, no, I actually kind of agree with both of you. I just kind of wanted your kind of opinion because I feel – not that the last few weeks have been bad, but I just definitely felt they've been maybe a little light on some of their star power. Just didn't feel as, you know, didn't feel like they were really giving, I don't know necessarily their all is the right word, but just definitely like it, they felt like they were in a definite kind of pattern and they were maybe confident where they were at because they knew kind of they had this in a few weeks, but not thinking, oh, maybe we're missing a little something. I guess the next thing I want to talk about, because I kind of tuned in a little later, I don't know if you guys talked about this at all, but I think one of the things with the finish with Jericho going off the cage with me is that when you see Darby getting thrown earlier down a flight of stairs, and then Jericho landing on a bunch of crash pads, I don't know. There's just like a weird disconnect where it's like I'm seeing a real like stunt with no padding or anything, and it's just
yeah.
I don't think you can have both in the same show. You know, at least do it on different weeks. That was just something where I just that consistency, setting consistency for like your world that you're in is always important to me, and I just think that was a little bit of a breaker for me that just didn't work.
And I want to take a moment to say, I don't want to do what Chris Jericho did. And there's danger involved. And I don't know exactly what the surface was, the corrugated steel type thing, but there was a chance for something to go wrong. I mean, I'm not saying there wasn't some whoa factor to it. My issue is the crash pad stuff has been done so much that it comes across as one of the last cons of kind of a modern era where wrestlers all, you know, are breaking character constantly, and promoters are, you know, talking about things, whether it's Triple H or Tony or whomever, you know, just talking about it openly being showbiz, and there's no pretense. Yet they sort of sell the idea that we're not supposed to notice that it's a crash pad and that it's really a big deal. So it just, yeah, it's just, I just think it's overdone. It doesn't look as real as like 99 other things they did in the preceding half hour. So when the big spot at the end is, oh, my God, I can't believe he did that, and it looks more fake than 99 things that they did with weapons and moves, I just say stick to weapons and moves and stop doing the greatest hits of the Attitude Era equivalent radio station on AEW and take it to the next level and be more nuanced and sophisticated. And, my God, they had people bleeding and hitting each other with stuff, and there's all kinds of cool wrestling moves. Just keep it in the damn cage and – don't go to the tired, cliched, overdone move because you think it's so high impact for the point you're making, Sam, because what Darby did looked way more real and intense and dangerous. It is hard to make that spot look good. So I didn't mean to go and repeat myself again, but the idea of Jericho doing it, I don't want to take away that took some guts, and it's not something he normally does, and that's great. It's more the artistic choice to even do it.
100% agree. That's just, it's not, you know, I understand you wanted probably to do something memorable, but yeah, it's just sometimes you need to kind of curate and edit and decide, like, what's most important for, you know, sometimes you have to just, you know, kind of think what's best in the totality of the show, I think. And I think that just kind of, you know, when you're putting something together.
And have faith, if you're a good author and you're writing a mystery novel and you reveal, and it's a great reveal at the end, like a great twist, in the book, you don't have to increase the font size and do all caps and add colors. Like, and that's what this was. This was like, let's take this climax and let's kind of do something that, like, you know, somebody who didn't have the power to be sophisticated with just traditional grammar and language, build at the moment and reveal it. And to me, you know, stick with the same font size and don't go all caps and don't change the color. Don't add, you know, pink hearts or blood stains or whatever to the page. Just tell your story using the tools that you have in the confines of the roofed cage. And I stick to that. You know, like, have confidence that that's enough. And I think with that crew in that cage, they should have had confidence that they could build to a crescendo staying inside of it. To me, AW is counter-programming WWE in certain ways, but seem completely unself-aware of what really is driving people nuts or numbing them to things. And one of them is nothing that happened matters until you get to the stunt bump, you know, in a match like this. And I think they should be pushing back and counter-programming that philosophically more than some strident adherence to every match will end with a clean finish. I think it's, you know, both are important, but it seems selective, oddly selective, to think one is important and the other isn't. Sam, anything else?
Yeah, I guess just on that one last point question on that, and then I'll head out. I guess with that, I was kind of thinking to kind of combat that. Do you think at all maybe they should have, and I understand why they didn't, especially since they tore up the ring and everything. Do you think maybe they should have started the night with Blood and Guts so that we weren't, you know, I even know I looked at my clock right when it was ending. I was like, well, definitely there's something else going to happen here since we have this time. And I think that's a way to possibly combat it is if you started it a little earlier or something and then went to something afterwards. Just a thought I had. Otherwise, go VIP and have a good night.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it. They had time for Jericho to clearly express some instructions to MJF after the when they were on top of the cage. I can't remember if it was right before the finish or right after. I think it was after the finish. And we could see Jericho saying some things to MJF, so they might have had, you know, some sort of countdown clock, and Jericho was giving him tips on what to say or how to act in the meantime to fill some time, or I don't know, or just giving a green light to that he was okay for it. I don't think if they started with Blood and Guts, Jake, that it would have solved the issue of the cage being, you know, you can't lower it from the ceiling, you know, so you have to build it. So I don't think deconstructing it, if anyone's ever built a bookshelf or a desk from IKEA or wherever and did something wrong, it's not easier to deconstruct and get back to your mistake than it is to build it in the first place. So I'm not sure that there would have been enough time to do in reverse, you know, the cage if it was a problem to begin with.
No, and I guess the, you know, the crash pad part of it is going to get a lot of attention and analysis. I think the lesson to take away from this is that if you can't make it look really good, maybe just don't do it. Because, you know, it was clearly a crash pad, and, you know, they had it covered with some kind of it didn't look like steel, because if you watch the replay, the underside of it looks very similar to cardboard. And so I don't know if it was, like, textured and painted, like, cardboard tiles or something that they laid on top of the crash pad to give it the appearance of being like the regular ramp material. But it certainly, you know, there's no way to show that, to have people believe that it wasn't a crash pad of some sort. And so unless you can get creative with the camera angles, it's probably maybe next time take a different approach, I think is the takeaway from this. I know they wanted to spotlight MJF and give him that big moment to make him look like a major heel, but I think you could have crafted a situation that could have got you there in the ring, and I think next time they'll probably go down that road given the response to this. I think it might have been a bit of an overreaction to how poorly the deathmatch barbed wire situation went, where they're like, yeah, damn it, we're going to give you what we promised this time. And I think
he should have had gigantic explosions when Jericho landed.
Exactly.
that would have been so meta and so hilarious.
Yeah, that would have definitely made the night. But I think they got the reception from that, and they were embarrassed by it, and they were going to make something huge happen here, and perhaps overcompensation led to some decisions that in hindsight you might do differently the next time around.
You might be right. I also think had the explosions gone perfectly, just based on the larger approach that Tony Khan and company are taking, I think they would have done this anyway, Jake. I think this is in their DNA. I think they just would have said, let's leave the cage and let's do a spot on the top and let's have Sammy yell from the bottom, we surrender. It came across as an escape hatch to avoid someone giving up, which it probably wasn't, because there's so many people in that match that could give up. Even on the babyface side. I mean, does it destroy, I don't know, Santana to give up? No. Would it feel like a letdown if it's not one of the main characters? Maybe. To me, I'd have Jericho lose. And give up. I don't think there's any shame in that. MJF would never let him hear the end of it. And I think there are ways to do that within the cage. But it might have been on their mind. Maybe if the thought crossed their mind, let's do something more traditional. They might have thought, no, after last time, we have to go all the way. But my tendency is to think Tony just defaults to, ooh, let's do lights out. Ooh, let's do, the things that are sort of that he liked back in the day. It's getting to do them as a promoter now, if WWE's not doing it especially, he just goes there.
Yeah, that just may be, baked into his creative DNA, so to speak. Yeah. I guess we'll see if that is the pattern going forward. But I think, if they're seriously listening to, the feedback on this, and I think the online conversation is fairly similar to the one that we're having here. There should be, some lessons and takeaways from that. And it's not all bad. There are a lot of people who love the match and have a lot of positive things to say about it, including me. I enjoyed quite a bit of it. And so I hope they, they don't take it as people just unfairly trying to tear them down. I think that with just a few tweaks, this could have been a much better match.
All right, very good. Let's go next to Alex in Montreal, and then on deck, Jay in Hartford. Go ahead, Alex. Thanks for calling. What'd you think of Dynamite and our conversation so far?
Hey, guys. I had a lot of fun with the show tonight. Number one, I thought the cage looked fantastic.
Good point, yeah.
Once the second hour started, it just looked incredibly solid, just looming over everyone. And I'm glad that, the top was closed. I'm glad that it wasn't, too low. It looked like a very imposing but solid structure. So just the visual of the cage, I thought was tremendous. The match itself, I share most of your sentiments and, most of what the callers are saying regarding the ending feeling a little flat, but because the rest of the match, especially the first, I'll say the first 15 minutes or so, were so good. And by good, I mean just intense. I loved the intro shot of Dax standing in one ring, Sammy standing in the other, and they got a nice wide angle of the two of them before they started running at each other. And they have tremendous chemistry, so I would love to see a singles match between those two somewhere down the line, basically Dax and anybody. So yeah, I thought, I think AEW knew that they had and were going to have a lot of eyeballs on the show tonight. Hopefully some new eyeballs who, maybe caught onto the hype of this event and that it's going to be this big violent affair. So I thought from a presentation standpoint, hopefully they managed to snag some new viewers. That's kind of what I'm hoping. I don't know how people who are just tuning in are going to feel about that ending. I was reading some online reactions that were saying that, a lot of the old War Games matches also had some flat endings when it came to the heels winning. I can't verify. I haven't watched one of those in ages, but, overall I was quite satisfied. Honestly, like the first hour, I was just kind of looking at the clock a little bit. Outside of like the very memorable visual of Anthony Ogogo draping the American Nightmare with the Union Jack flag. I thought that was a pretty, you know, striking visual. The first hour, I was just clock watching. I just really wanted the main event to start, and I think a lot of people were probably in the same boat. So anyway, yeah, what did you think in terms of how AEW presented themselves tonight as potentially, you know, chasing that second million? And do you think it did feel special to you? Like, to me, it felt like an incredibly kind of special show, even though everything didn't hit. So, yeah, what's your guys' take on that?
Yeah, I mean, Moxley and Kenny in the ring, you know, even if it's at 8 minutes and we know who's going to take the fall, feels like a good start to a TV show that's building to a main event. Cody and QT, they put a lot of time into it. I mean, I'm trying to really give QT a chance. I don't know that he's still worth – I'm still at the point where I just don't know that he's worth the TV time they're giving to him. I mean, I think there's a really low ceiling on how interesting he is as a opponent of a top-level guy like Cody. He's just – there's just nothing that jumps out about him. You know, I mean, I'm sorry. It's just – there just isn't. And I don't think he should be – in a match that is this high profile. Britt Baker winning a squash, the four-way tag, which was, you know, a bunch of moves, and then it was an Omega promo, and the main event. I mean, I didn't think it was spectacular, but I thought it was not atypical of a regular episode of Dynamite, and it was fine. You know, I mean, I think that there was enough variety to everything that came up that aired before the main event that it was I'd call it a sufficient show leading up to the main event. And I think probably smartly constructed in terms of who they put out there and how long they featured them and how much they gave away and kind of the level of matchup that was presented leading up to the main event. Just enough to keep people interested with stars and action, some promos and development for what's coming up. Jake, how about you? What'd you think?
Yeah, I think AEW is on the right track with a couple of their programs. You know, I think there's heading into a pay-per-view. I think it's May 30th. At the end of this month. You know, they tend to end load their pay-per-view builds in a pretty major way. You know, they'll shift gears now. They got basically 3 weeks of television. I want to say because of Chris Jericho's Fozzy tour dates, he probably won't be back until the go-home show. So if they plan on booking him for the pay-per-view, he might not even appear on TV until the go-home to make that match. But I do think they have, you know, some programs that are going to be pay-per-view worthy. You know, Cody is supposed to address his Double or Nothing plans next week, where we're supposed to see a number one contenders match for the world championships. I assume once Moxley is finished with Nagata, he and Kingston will challenge for the tag championships. So I think Dynamite is probably going to be a better show over the next 3 weeks heading into the pay-per-view because they have a lot of work to do, and we'll have to see if they can balance how much they have to get accomplished from a booking perspective with not making the shows feel too packed with content. I think some of their episodes do stray into being just too tightly booked from a timing perspective, and it can make the entire show feel rushed as a result. But I do think that heading into Double or Nothing, they're in an okay place. Like they do seem to have the pieces in ready to go to build a fairly strong pay-per-view card.
All right, very good. Let's go back to Alex. Any follow-up on that or additional topic?
Yeah, just to follow up on what another caller was talking about and, you know, the card being loaded up next week, I agree with you guys that I think I'm really happy with them going like 100 miles an hour all the time because you know, if they had new eyeballs today, hopefully they saw that card for next week and feel excited about it.
Yeah.
And you're getting three title matches and you're getting Orange Cassidy and Pac, who had One of the most memorable matches at, you know, Revolution 20, what year are we in? You know, the one before this past Revolution. So yeah, I think like next week, surprisingly, I'm even like more excited for the card next week than I was for this week, which I have to applaud AEW for even, you know, making that possible. I didn't think that would happen given the magnitude of the match that we saw today. The second thing that I want to mention to you guys is I think we can't really take for granted how well AEW is doing with building up the foundation of their future. I mean, today we ended the show with MJF, and what I mean by that is like their non-former WWE guys future. So today we ended with MJF standing victorious atop the cage, positioned as a top heel in the company, second only to Kenny Omega, probably, who is, again, the AEW champion, another non-WWE wrestler. We have Darby Allin, who has been on a tear lately with the quality of his TNT title defenses on Dynamite, and who consistently is getting, you know, some of the highest 18 to 49 demo ratings for those people who care about those things. The other thing is you have Britt Baker, also non-WWE, really coming into her own in AEW, facing Hikaru Shida, who also, even with the challenge of, you know, not being able to speak English that well until recently, she is also like someone who feels like a big time player in AEW. And today, about the Kenny segment, I didn't feel that Orange Cassidy felt out of place at all confronting him. And that's because I had the history in my mind of what they've done, you know, to build him up to this point. So I had the match with Pac in my mind, you know, when he first really showed that, oh my God, this guy can actually wrestle, you know, that one time only event he's gonna have for his character. And then you had the Jericho program where he came out on top of that. Like he won 2 of 3 matches. I believe that's what it was with that one. So ever since that Jericho program, I mean, he cooled off, but he always felt like somebody who you could slot in at any time and heat up at any time because of the work they had already done with him. And so today when he was standing there with Kenny, who was a little bit meandering, I thought that, you know, he could have caught a minute of his promo, probably just like I can cut a minute off this phone call. Sorry for taking so much time. He really, you know, felt like he belonged there. And I am excited by the prospect of Orange Cassidy versus Kenny Omega at Double or Nothing. I mean, you know, they tipped their hand with who's going to win next week probably, but I'm ready for it. Give it to me. So yeah, I think they're doing a really great job of getting people in through the door with the Moxleys, the Codys, the Jerichos, and then keeping people around with this homegrown talent. And this is, again, without even mentioning Hangman Adam Page, without even mentioning Jungle Boy. So they've got, you know, a broad pool and a deep pool of talent that they're putting in the work into right now, and I hope that they see the benefits of that, you know, moving forward in the future.
Yeah, I think that's one of the strengths. Thank you, Alex. I think it's one of the strengths, Jake, of AEW is I don't think people would have thought in the first 18 months, and actually at the time it's been a weakness. It feels contradictory to say that, but I think they should have done a better job with Kenny and the Bucks, for instance. And I think Cody sort of been underutilized to a degree that might be hard to fully recover from, actually, in terms of just how much his momentum stopped and just being seemingly away for a while or not involved in anything. And then now QT Marshall, you know, maybe he's good enough to get revved up again. But nevertheless, the names he mentioned and the youth in this company and the new stars they're creating, you could subtract right now Jake Hager, Chris Jericho, John Moxley, let us think about that, Kenny Omega, the Young Bucks, Jake Roberts, and Christian, who is he even, all from the company, Oh, and Taz. Like, let's subtract him. Like, all those sort of – I'm trying to, like, hit all the big names, like, with the highest, you know, kind of general wrestling fan recognition factor. You could subtract literally everybody I just mentioned. I don't know that they'd be in terrible shape. I mean, it'd be a step back, but they wouldn't be in terrible shape. You cannot say that about the Raw roster or the SmackDown roster or the NXT roster. That undercurrent of talent and the – it's not an ensemble like where everyone's equal. That's not good, but – There is that handful of talent that not only has been pushed, but I think there's a handful of mid-card talent that they could push harder, and fans would buy into it. Sometimes, you know, like, are they skipping a stage with Orange Cassidy? Maybe, maybe not. Alex doesn't think so. Others do, in terms of kind of getting everyone onto that place with Orange at this level. Jake, your thoughts to that point?
Yeah, I think AEW has a lot of promising younger talent, and I guess from my personal taste, I think they have work to do, not necessarily from an in-ring standpoint, because I think most of AEW's young talent can hang in that regard, but it's more about TV experience and selling a pay-per-view with a promo and telling a long-form story in a wrestling environment. And I think a lot of the younger AEW characters feel like they very much are trying to emulate what was working on the U.S. Indies before they got to the company in a lot of ways. And I think that attracts a particular type of audience, and I think it can get them, clearly it can get them a million plus viewers, but I don't know if it can get you to that, you know, topping 2 million or getting close to it, because the television environment is going to be really competitive, and they're catering to a specific niche inside of wrestling, and I think that's an area where AEW has some growing to do, because as much as I enjoy the week-to-week show and as much as they do tell, stories that you can follow, I don't think they quite capture the really mature, you know, type of viewer and the electricity of really great wrestling stories most of the time. It feels like they're missing something in that regard. But in terms of comparing the two companies, AEW is doing a much better job of getting across how valuable its young stars are.
Yeah. Good points. Alex, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
No problem, guys. Have a great night.
Yep, you too. All right. Let's go next here to Jay in Hartford. And then after that, Steve in Baltimore. Go ahead, Jay. Your thoughts on tonight's show.
Hey, Wade, Jake. Good evening. I enjoyed the show for the most part. Kind of fast-forwarded through it so that I could call in, pretty much had, you know, having seen the whole thing.
Sure.
So first of all, shout out to Ashley who called in earlier. It was so fun to hear a live attendee call in.
Yes.
I mean, I loved it. So,
like
you said, we made it, right? So,
yes.
With Blood and Guts, so here's my thing, Wade. I thought that, and again, I fast-forwarded through it, but I saw certain parts of it. First of all, I enjoyed hearing the crowd. I thought they were really into it. And there were certain parts of the match that I really liked. Just little things like when Ortiz first came in, I thought he came in on fire and it was fun. And, you know, again, the crowd was into it. What I didn't like about the match, and you covered it a little bit earlier, I mean, it was Blood and Guts, right? I just thought there was too much blood. So I'm not anti-blood. I'm not like, oh, I can't take blood. But I think, and this is just me sitting at home watching, I have no idea, right? But I get the impression with AEW that it's like, oh, look what we can do. You know, like WWE, they're PG and they're, you know, they don't really do blood, or they try not to do it as much, whatever. And it's like, oh, but we can do blood. You know, when the match started, I think it started with Sammy Guevara and Dax Harwood. And he was again, I was kind of fast-forwarding through it a little bit, and so he was bleeding. I'm like, the match just started. Where did this blood come from? What was the spot? Like, I just thought it was too much, too soon. And next thing you know, I thought there was this blood everywhere, and I just it felt like it wasn't necessary. Again, to me, it's just like, oh, look, we can bleed. It felt like blood for the sake of blood. I thought maybe less is more is what I'm getting at. So I don't know if you guys noticed that, if you thought it was too much, the right amount, or what are your thoughts there?
Jake, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think they went a little overboard at some points where it was just like, okay, suddenly everybody is bleeding, and I don't really know if they showed me on camera why. And if it's not really part of the story of the match, that it wasn't important enough to show it happening, then I don't know if it was really necessary. Like, I literally think they tried to explain, Sammy Guevara running Dax into the cage a couple of times as being responsible for the blood, but he clearly came up from that pop-up cutter I think it was a springboard cutter that Sammy hit bleeding like crazy. And so
yeah.
I think he bladed at that point. And then as soon as Cash Wheeler was in the match, it seemed like he was bleeding immediately. And I think he might have got himself more severely than Dax did. But those two were certainly they came into this match looking to give you as much blood as you could handle. Like, it was on their mind. They must have wanted to live up to the namesake. But I can't say that much of the blood had anything to do with the story of the match, because it didn't really play into the conclusion at all. You know, it wasn't like, you know, blood loss led to somebody surrendering the match. It was, you know, the last 10 minutes of the match were all eight competitors other than MJF and Jericho were essentially non-factors in the finish. And so it did feel a little superfluous to have all that blood in the match.
Yep. I agree. I think it plays into what Jay said. You know, it's like, look what we can do. And you know, they had parental discretion advisories at least twice at the beginning and mid show. Jay, any follow-up or other points?
I think they do that with they did it with the blood tonight, and although I didn't hear it tonight, so maybe this kind of goes against my point, but I think they do it with the swearing, like, oh, we can say the S word, and sometimes it's like, stop, take a week off, maybe they took a week off tonight because I didn't hear it, but even the B word, I mean, WWE, they use that too, but I think that word gets used a lot more now in wrestling, it's just like, we don't need it all the time. It doesn't always add. Sometimes it adds impact, and sometimes it feels just like, I think Scorpio Sky used it tonight, and I enjoyed his promo, which is another point I wanted to get to. But then when he ended with calling him a B, I was like, it didn't really help. It just felt like, oh, I'm going to throw this in there because I can. But then I'll move to that if I can, right? Ethan Page, I loved his promo. I absolutely loved it. Like, I don't know about the history with him and Darby Allin. So I appreciated that he goes, hey, I'm not going to talk about a bunch of matches that no one's ever seen. And so it just kind of, I don't know if they meant that in a meta type way, but it reminded me of the conversations that are had on this show, Wade, and you bring up, like, there are things that they expect us to know as viewers. Like, I don't watch Dark or any of the other shows besides Dynamite, right? So I don't always know the backstory. I don't watch Being the Elite, none of that. So it just felt like, thank you for not expecting me to know that, you know, you and Darby Allin have some long storied history, but yet the way he explained, like, you know, but I'm responsible for his injuries, I don't know, the mark on his face or something. Like, I just thought the promo was really, really good, so much so that when Darby came in to attack him, I'm like, oh, I wanted to hear what else he had to say, you know. But then I also loved the Darby running, so I just thought that was great. I don't know if we – I think I heard a little bit about it tonight, but I don't know how well you guys thought, you know, Ethan Page did in that promo, because I loved it.
Jake, go ahead and talk about that. What jumped out to you as far as, Ethan is, he's talented, and I hope I hope they figure out how to use them really well. I'm not saying it's going to be the next MJF, but there's something there.
Yeah, there definitely is. He's got a natural tendency of getting under your skin on the microphone, and I enjoyed his portion of the promo. Scorpio Sky, not as much, and we talked about a little bit of that earlier. He started out by stealing a line from a movie, and then he ended with the unnecessary curse word that just kind of felt like it was there for shock value, and I don't think anybody's shocked by it at this point. But Ethan is great. I he was intense. He didn't quite take the language as far. You know, he didn't talk about, you know, murdering Darby Allin at some point. You know, he just kept it to the brutality of, hey, you know, this guy, you know, we have history, and it's because I've heard him before, and I'm willing to do it again to get what I want. And those are the kinds of heel promos that I can dig, because it keeps it in the context of, hey, this is a pro wrestling show, and I have desires that fit into the framework of pro wrestling, and it's not about, you know, something that completely kind of leaves me in the dark. You know, you quote Batman and you talk about murder in your promo, I'm probably kind of trailing off at some point.
Yeah, and there was a little bit with Scorpio Sky of, hey, look, I'm a heel now. You know, like just in the whole kind of approach and the wording and the demeanor and stuff. And so anyway, Jay, anything else you want to bring up before I move on?
Sure. Last thing, and I'll let you go. And that was, I just lost it. It was like right there.
Well, it'll come back to you as soon as you stop trying to think of it. That's just how our brains
work. Of course it will.
Work.
And if it does, I'll shoot an email. I'm not even going to hold you. You got Steve waiting, but thanks for all you do, man. Have a good night, guys.
Cool. Yeah. I'll check the inbox. No problem. Well, you've been listening for, you know, over 2 hours, so that can happen. All right. Thanks, Jay. All right. Let's we'll go to Steve in Baltimore and then wrap up with Javier. Steve, thanks for calling. Thanks for holding. What do you think of Dynamite and our conversation so far?
I liked your conversation a lot more. I was entertained by the blood and guts match, but like some caller said, too much blood. I think Hager was bleeding before he even got in the match, and no fight on the outside. And there was a really scary
spot. I know this isn't a video podcast, but Jake and I both bladed while covering the match too.
I believe it. I think all of us had to. It was a requirement. When Sammy did a springboard from one ring into the other and wiped out, I think he seriously got concussed because he was not doing much for a long time after that. Nobody checked on him. He kind of rolled around in the ring on the mat. Did you guys pick up on that?
Jake, did you?
I can't say that I did. I thought you were starting to talk about the spot with Spears where he did the Spanish fly from one ring to the other. That was kind of cool. But I think you're referencing something else.
Yeah, it was when one of the FTR guys like ducked the clothesline and he was going to springboard and take him out, but he like messed up the flip somehow and landed. He landed on his head really hard, wiped himself out basically.
Okay.
I noticed he was grabbing his head and rolled around, and nobody checked on him. And he didn't do much for a long time after that until later in the match. So,
well, he also took that mostly unprotected chair shot earlier, so I'm sure he was feeling it at that point.
Definitely. And there was another scary spot where Hager ran at Wardlow. Wardlow tried to like pick him up in a fireman, and then it just fell backwards into the ropes that were already messed up, and looked like he landed real bad on his neck there. It was a lot of botches.
Yeah, it was a lot.
Could have went bad with another inch another way. Yeah, and that's pretty common for AEW, it seems like.
I would like, if they're going to do a chair shot protected chair shot only, to the head, and they do it once every 18 months, I want that to be the finish. You know, I just don't think there's much. I mean, I know there's a whole history of, you know, the Foley Rock unfortunateness of that and all kinds of, you know, baggage. But if you sort of hit the reset button and make a chair shot to the head enough to end a match, And I would vote for never doing it, but if you're going to do it once every 18 months and have it be the finish, not just another spot. And, you know, that gets to the just the tone here of just sort of a excessiveness. And, you know, if we do this more, if this is good, then more of this would be even better. And there just does – you just sort of look for AEW to sort of have the wisdom collectively to see when pulling back is going to lead to everything having more impact. Because they're – you know, it's not just about botches or guys getting legit hurt. It's just the theme of they were trying to do too much. And even if everything was smooth, it's like you just – it's a blur by the end. So many things just get lost. I just have this have the self-confidence that not everybody is waiting to turn the channel every minute that they're watching the show. And that if you tell a good story and have a reputation for telling good stories, people will stick around even if it's not – blood and big spots constantly during that main event.
Absolutely. I heard a caller earlier saying that they think Tony cares more about after what happened with, you know, Matt Hardy bounced his head and then many other times. I don't think he does at all. I think he's way more reckless than Vince would let the wrestlers be. Another point of last week, Moxley and Kingston had both Nakazawa and John Moxley with their ankles in the chair had the opportunity to break both their ankles, and they gave it up to get this tag match this week in which they got virtually no revenge and got wiped out by the end of it. It made them look absolutely stupid in my eyes. Did you guys pick up on that?
Jake, what'd you think?
Yeah, I kind of commented on that earlier where it's Kingston and Moxley are, at least at various times, have been, you know, pushed to the audience as two of the smartest characters on the show, just in terms of their ability to perceive what their opponents are doing and what their motivations are and get under their skin and you know, dissect the psychology of their enemy. And then you put them together, and apparently that results in a net IQ loss of staggering proportions because they continue to get outsmarted by, you know, relatively basic heel tactics, and they risk losing an opportunity at revenge last week when they had Omega dead to rights to get a tag match that had basically no stakes whatsoever. And so I agree. I think they're missing the boat on that program in a pretty major way, and it's making Kingston and Moxley look rather foolish in the process.
I want to slip in this mini rant, which is I just want referees to stop calling for the bell after the heels beat up the baby faces illegally before the bell. It's so dumb. I could rant on this for 2 minutes. I'm not going to, but just stop doing it. You don't reward heels for a pre-match attack any more than if an NFL team ran on the field and grabbed the football and ran down to the 1 yard line and before being tackled, you go, well, I guess they get to start at the one. Like, no, that's not okay. If a heel attacks a baby face before the match, you pause, you let the baby faces fully recover. You scold the heels as a warning. If not, delay the match till later. This idea of you just get rewarded for a pre-match attack with a ref frantically calling for the bell. It's just low IQ producing of a match. It's like, let's add freneticness to the show and adrenaline. It's like, but it makes no effing sense. And it just takes me out of it. And it makes me not have faith in the people putting matches together when that stuff is done. And, you know, if the ref asks the face, you're ready to go, and the face says yes, then from a character standpoint, I think less of the baby face, because it's like, no, I want the full 2 minutes. Or not. I'm thinking of UFC with low blows. I need time to recover. I mean, the stakes are high, and I just got the crap kicked out of me from behind by a heel. So stop doing that. They did it in the first two matches, and it was just like stuff like that. It just bugs me, and I shake my head. Anyway, I guess it was almost 2 minutes. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I think they're not going to grow the audience unless they introduce logic and believability to what they do. I don't think they can. I think they can keep their audience they have now, but they need logic and believability. There's so many things like the leg lock that supposedly took Sting out. That you can tell Scorpio Sky has no idea how to apply a heel hook or a knee bar, whatever he was trying to do, what he was doing.
Yeah.
There's enough people that train MMA and jiu-jitsu nowadays that they could tell when something's legitimate and it's not. That what he was doing was not going to hurt Sting at least, but I didn't think Sting looked like he was that injured last week. I can't remember. I thought he did something after the attack, but maybe not. There's so much. There's always something. Every match has something going on after it, and always got to be. Can't just be a finish and move on. So you forget everything. Yep. Even in the Cody QT Marshall match they had afterbirth again. They need logic and believability. I think that's the two things they need to grow to the next million.
All right, cool. Steve, great talking to you. Thanks for holding so long and contributing.
Thank you.
You bet. All right, we'll wrap up here with Javier, PW Torch VIP podcaster and contributor from Miami. Javier, we've gone long. What have we left for you, or what do you want to add to our conversation? Welcome.
Hey, Jake. Hey, Wade. How's it going? Hey, I was actually looking at the when I was watching it, and I went back to check it out because I wanted to see how they took it. I was surprised about the chair shot too. He actually takes it on the shoulder because I actually have it paused right now. Sammy Guevara is tucking his head in away from the chair, and he's going at it with his shoulder. So it looked, and then the camera like cuts away really quick. There was another one that was obvious. I didn't actually look at it because I think it was too tied. Whoever else got hit by it, you could tell that they took it like on the shoulder and on the back from the direction it came. I'm not saying that, for people who are, at least it looked fit from what I saw, those two shots.
Yeah.
I don't know if there were any more. As far as the match goes, I pretty much, all the negative stuff, I got to agree with it. My first thoughts, when the match goes to start, I settle down because I'm like, okay, let's see what they do. I went with I'm not going to compare it to NXT or because I've enjoyed the NXT ones or any of that stuff. I'm like, go in with an open mind. What I wanted to see was a simple match. I didn't want them to get too cute with it. It's your first one. I wanted to hearken more back to the original. I was hoping not to have weapons from the get-go, and like any weapons introduced would be introduced by Tully through like the outside or whatever, one of those slipping the brass knucks kind of thing. I was hoping that they wouldn't go outside, and sure enough, none of that happened. And Derek was Derek. I mean, he pretty much like I couldn't put into words what was bothering me about the match, but I think Derek put a good point that they never really sold any of the moments, and it never really felt like they were trying to win the match at any moment. The stuff that was going inside was very, it was weird because it was just, I expect it felt like there was not too much selling, and I think that might have been also, I fast forward through the commercials, so I didn't watch the picture-in-picture stuff, so that also threw things off. There were moments I would see people bleeding. I'm like, when the hell did that happen? Key moments that either happened during a commercial or like off, when the camera was panning onto something else. It was just not, it was fine. I didn't hate the match, but, and then you go to the outside and you do that whole skit. And at least you've got a really great shot you can use in your little, trailer things of a bloody MJF looking like a badass up there. But then, when they do the crash pads sequence, if you're going to do that, keep the camera away from the action. And instead the camera tracks Jericho on his way down so you can see that he's landing on a mat. There was nothing to it's like they'd even try to hide the magic. And you can tell that the panels are actually non-slip, non-slip rubber, on cardboard. So So I'm like, and when you had all these people bleeding underneath there, and you have that, the entire segment goes on for with them on top of the cage goes on for way too long without ever them cutting to any action, It was not a very. The more as this conversation has gone on, the least I like it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think this match it's a manifestation of I think what some people really like about AEW and what some people find really frustrating and undisciplined about AEW, and it I think there's a lot to extrapolate from it that could help AEW improve. You know, I've been using the word curate about the AEW style from I don't know if it was week one or week three of Dynamite, but maybe it was before that with the pay-per-views. But there's just I wouldn't want Tony Khan running my museum because it would just be there'd be everything everywhere, you know, like just everything everywhere. There'd be good things, but yeah, just after all this time, this match sort of was a manifestation of more is better and more on top of more is better. And it's not. And yeah, even the choice of the camera angle, like, yeah, I was with you. That definitely crossed my mind. I'm like, why are they zooming in on, you know, the revealing of the magic of this? Not that there was an angle they could use that wouldn't, that would have looked great, but they actually picked the angle you would pick if you were trying to expose wrestling as fake for a 2020 John Stossel special. We had a Stossel reference for Max Caster, so I thought I'd throw that in. Jake, anything you want to add on that?
No, I think, you know, we roast, you know, WWE's production choices all the time, whether you're talking about Kevin Dunn's 42 camera cuts every 60 seconds or, you know, the way that they angle things sometimes that gives things away during matches, shows the spaces in strikes and things along those lines. I think it's perfectly fair to criticize AEW for some of their production mistakes. And that was yeah, certainly one at the end of the show. I mean, if they knew they were going to the crash pad and that was the spot, I mean, you know, they didn't do a good enough job of hiding the crash pad. You know, a lot of times you'll see, you know, they'll put boxes or you know, something to kind of hide the fact that there's a giant crash pad underneath. But as Javier said, it was basically some rubber carpeting mats on top of a cardboard base. And so you could tell immediately what was happening as soon as Jericho landed. And then the angle they chose to shoot it with and the immediate replays of after the fact didn't add to the experience. So, like, and I hope it's, you know, when they look back on it and reflect on it, they identify that, you know, it's the constructive criticism that's intended there. It's like there's a better way to do that, and it was missed this time around.
Yeah. All right, Javier, anything else?
And on the blood, you know, I was fine with the blood. The thing is that it definitely felt like the heels were bleeding a lot in this, which I think was also mentioned. I mean, that's fine because, you know, for when the babyface bleeds, it's to get sympathy, but when the heel bleeds, it's to gain catharsis. But the problem is that we already got that a few weeks ago when Hardwood or Cash, one of the two, were when they had that brawl in the back and one of them was bleeding. So we already had that catharsis, so we already saw them bleed. So it's not like you're getting it as much in this one. So, you know, so you didn't really have like that much of a payoff to see the heels bleed and, you know, the how it's done. Yeah. So I think you had like a lot of the, you know, you wanted to produce these moments, but you never really did the work to get there, to earn them.
Yeah. Yep. Well put. Yeah.
On the Kenny Omega thing with Orange Cassidy, I was surprised by the reaction that I wouldn't say surprised, but I was happy with the reaction that Cassidy got. That, you know, the fans definitely felt like they were ready to see these two square off, because I was worried about like what would the reaction would be, you know, once Cassidy was like, I think, what, ranked number one. It's, you know, would people really buy into Kenny Omega and Cassidy, and the fans were into it. I don't think Kenny Omega, I agree with, I forgot who mentioned it because it's been a long call with, but Kenny's not scared of him at all. I think he's just being, you know, super dismissive. and he's already preparing for PAC because, you know, he knows that's going to be his opponent. And they did feel like they overplayed their hand a little bit in terms of, you know, how brutal he was in his dismissal of Cassidy to make me think that Cassidy's going to win. It's almost pretty obvious. So
I was trying to think, is there a double swerve going on here? Because it was so heavy-handed and obvious. Like, they can't possibly imagine a heel going, I want to face this guy. I don't want to face this guy. It just, to me, removed any mystery to the point where I think they have to book PAC to win just to make us think they weren't that heavy-handed and obvious.
Yeah, and speaking of heavy-handed, I forgot that was another thing I had an issue with the main event was also they mentioned at least twice, maybe more, that there are only two keys that the refs have, and at that point I'm like, they're gonna get the keys out, and you know that's how they're gonna get out of the cage or something's gonna go on, because you mentioned it once at the beginning, that's fine because you know you're creating the thing, but like I think they mentioned it like when they got the second time. I'm like, oh, they're trying to, you know, reinforce the idea because this is going to come into play later. So which is kind of like a WWE thing to do. And like in contrast, I just watched before watching this also, maybe this is also why I'm soured, the Shingo Osprey match. And, you know, they set up the table, like these tables outside really early in the match. And then 30 minutes, they go to it, and I'm like, oh, I forgot they were there, and it was a cool spot. If the commentating team would saying, oh, there's a table outside, there's a table outside, there's a table outside, you're preparing
right.
me for somebody to go through the table.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of what happened, you know, in that one. So, and I did – it wasn't good, the line, but I got a kick out of it because – When Miro said, I found it funny. He was trying to make a play of what happens when the unstoppable force meets the immovable object. He was trying to make a play on that by saying, you know, what happens when the man who's not afraid to get to die meets the man who's not afraid of killing. And I'm like, well, you end up with two happy people. It's like.
Yes.
the two don't equate. That I don't think that went the direction that Miro wanted. But do you think he does win or because I could see him. I could see, you know, Miro winning and then Darby teaming up with Sting or Archer to go up against Ethan Page and Scorpio Sky without anything, or do you think that he might still go do that with the belt and then maybe friction between Darby Allin and, like, let's say Archer is his partner and then leads to them wrestling?
Jake, what do you think?
I think Miro wins. I think you can't really put him into this position now and have him lose again. I mean, it took them, is it almost a year at this point before being able to successfully, you know, get him away from Kip Sabian and the best man, which, I mean, Miro went out of his way to say he only came to AEW because of this great story they had planned for him. And it turned out to be a huge miss. And now he seems like he's on the right track, and they have an opportunity to really cement him as turning the corner. And I think it would be a mistake to go through all that trouble of having Darby be thrown down a flight of stairs as cover for losing the match next week and then have him win anyway. I mean, I don't think Darby needs the belt at this point to be over, particularly when he's closely involved with Sting. It seems like Miro actually needs it more at this point. I don't think Miro probably went out there intending to say tune in next week for my live snuff match, but that's how the promo came across. But it is what it is. You know, we had Scorpio Sky kind of talking about the same thing earlier with Sting. So that's a pet peeve of mine when people talk about murder in their promos. But I guess, you know, this didn't come across as well as he hoped.
I think Miro having a run with the TNT title is great for him. I think he needs something to establish, you know, his singles credibility, and eventually you want to be able to headline a pay-per-view with him against Hangman Page, perhaps, in an AEW World title match a year from now. And if they're kind of planting the seeds and building towards that, that's one of the strengths of AEW is, you know, you can look back at certain things, and I know the pandemic kind of it disrupted some of that, but if you can, you know, imagine a year from now, Miro being in a world title match, having a dominant TNT title run for a while is a really good way to let viewers know that's what this guy's about. He's serious and he can hold the title and he's badass and he's tough and he backs up his words. And then also gives you a chance to put him in top main event matches on Dynamite where he can get his personality across that isn't just self-indulgently talking about video games and seeming like he's just goofing off after school. So yeah, this is a move in the right direction, Javier.
Yeah, and Jake, it's funny you mentioned snuff because that word comes to mind way too often whenever I see too many things involving Darby Allin for my comfort. So in terms of like the Hangman Page, as you had mentioned, you know, Hangman Page and Omega, I am glad they took him out of the picture last week because I think that the two biggest matches for Omega in AEW are going to be Hangman Page and Cody Rhodes if they ever get around to those. So I, you know, and when he does face Hangman Page, I mean, that's pretty much at the point where you're tying up Kenny Omega's story. And I think they want to go a lot more places with Kenny Omega before, you know, he ends up dropping the belt to Adam Page. Cause you know, if he wrestles Adam Page, I'm pretty sure Adam Page is going to have to win the title and he's going to be the one who beats Omega for it.
Yep. Very good. Javier, any closing words? We've ran really long. I don't want to keep Jake any longer here either.
Yeah, okay. I just want one line I really enjoyed was, and I got to hand it to Tony where, you know, he's definitely done a lot to get over the MJF's character. There's the point where I think Jericho had the turnbuckle pad and was attacking MJF and Tony yelled out, "You go, yeah, now gouge him with it." And I'm like, "Geez, Tony, relax."
Tony is like 30% like really good, 30% sort of neutral, and I guess doing math here, I don't want to say he's mostly bad, but because it's not so much bad as what, like they're just he'll just say things, and I'm like, "What did Tony?" No, like they're just he's unpredictable. He's unpredictable.
Well, the what for tonight was when Excalibur said Eddie Kingston is widening his base to prevent a suplex attempt. He said Eddie Kingston is widening his base, and Tony said, "Yeah, he's widening his base. He's also crouching down and using his leg muscles to make himself harder to get picked up." Like seriously?
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Yeah.
All right, guys. Have a good day.
All right, cool. Thanks, Javier. Yep, email any more thoughts you want. We'll bring them up on the flagship tomorrow.
Yeah, have a good one.
Thanks, yep. Jake, we've got some emails. We'll save them for the flagship tomorrow with Zach Hadorn because we have gone long. We got lots of callers and the on-site correspondent. Covered a lot of bases. There's still more to cover. The two emails in particular, one, loved the show and listed why. The other, hated the show and listed why. So we'll read those on the flagship tomorrow and kind of comment on them with Zach. Jake, anything else you want to add, stray thoughts or anything? And if so or if not, either way, plug your Twitter and what you do for ProWrestling.net.
Yeah, I think we covered everything. I don't really have a whole lot of additional thoughts on the show, but you can catch me over at ProWrestling.net Wednesdays for Dynamite live coverage. I also do the ProWrestling.net weekly main podcast with Jason Powell, .net weekly, as well as pay-per-view audio reviews with Jason, and those are all available for members. And if you're interested in membership of ProWrestling.net, it's pwmembership.net. So thanks for having me, Wade. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jake, very much. And thanks to our callers. Really fun conversation here on a big episode of Dynamite. We certainly won't go this long with our post shows regularly at all, but it was fun to there's a lot to talk about on this show. You can follow me on Twitter at TheWadeKeller and follow our brand at PWTorch. Please visit PWTorch.com for your daily news fix along with commentary and live TV coverage and pay-per-view coverage. And until tomorrow on the Blue Logo Show for the flagship, this is Wade Keller signing off.